So, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Boker Tov, good morning, and welcome back. We are going to, like I said just a second ago, as I was getting all the knobs and bells and whistles and everything twisted and in the right position, we're going to be all over the place this morning. The Torah portion is called Tetzaveh, and it starts in Exodus chapter 27, verse 20. We're going to start there. Because essentially what I want to do today is begin where I ended last night with some of the conclusions from the Torah portion in particular. And I want to make a couple of points from this, and I'm going to immediately begin, I guess you could say, by trying to go deep, by pointing out that there are a lot of ways to read that first verse, and we're going to at least imply that there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. So, as you know, the Torah portion begins with a first set of words in Hebrew, and the name for the Torah portion comes from one of those. Usually it's the first kind of unique word, the first something that's not a, you know, an article adjective or a "and Yahuwah said to Moshe" kind of a thing. And this one is the words in red where it says Yahuwah is saying, "You shall command," speaking to Moshe, "shall command," tetzaveh, there's the word, "the children of Israel." And the next two verses, literally the last two in chapter 27, have to do with what is being commanded. And I think, as I thought about this again, actually not for the first time, probably not for the 20th time, but it kind of opened itself up a little bit to my eyes and to what I want to start with today. "Command them that they bring to you pure olive oil, beaten for the light, to cause a lamp to burn continually." Now pause a second. Pure olive oil, beaten for the light. Now there's a lot we could say about that. The idea is that according to tradition and to the way that olive oil is usually processed, I guess is a good modern word for it. And a lot of respects, it's a little bit like winemaking too. There's a first pressing and then there's a second pressing. And if you go look in the books, you can find out about this. But the ripest olives essentially self-press. Similarly, grapes do the same thing. They get really, really ripe. The skins get ready to burst and you drop the olives in a vat. And they literally kind of pop open. The weight of the olives on top of them causes them just to self-explode. And this oil comes out. And this is the ripest, the freshest, the purest oil. It's beaten for light. Now, I want to compare and contrast a lot today, because I'm going to compare and contrast what we know Scripture actually says with the lies we have been told by our fathers for so long. With respect to Roman Catholicism and the, we got a liar wearing a fish hat running around today doing things that even by the standards of, yeah, I'll say it, the whore church are shocking people. That's how bad, that's how in your face things have gotten there. You know, by the same token, if you can kill a Supreme Court justice in plain sight, arrange the body, and then get away with breaking the law and saying, "We don't even give a you-know-what so much that we're going to ignore the law, not even have an inquest, much less an autopsy." Just understand here that if you say something we don't like in post-constitutional, post-biblical Babylon, we can kill you. And ain't nobody gonna even say anything about it. Ha ha ha. Now, let me go back again and ask, when it comes to pure olive oil that has been beaten for light, that is supposed to burn continually, to cause a lamp to burn continually, does there begin to be a metaphor in there that kind of leaps out at us? Are not his people being beaten today for light? Shouldn't we be a light to the world anyway? But isn't it interesting, of course, that the purest, the best of the olives are the ones that literally are ready to burst and to give forth some light? I think that's at least the beginning of where I want to start today. But I'm going to read the whole set of two verses here, too. "You shall command the children of Israel, the B'nai Israel, that they bring unto you pure olive oil beaten for light to cause a lamp to burn continually." Now listen to this and think, too, about what we've been told about the spiritualization of this tent of meeting, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, later the temple. We will be told, I don't need, the law is written on my heart anymore. That's one of the biggest lies in all of Christendom. The law is beaten. No, it's not. The law's been beaten out of me. I've been told it's been done away with for 17 centuries or more. It's been replaced because some guy in a fish hat, symbolizing a pagan fish god, has called up God on the red phone, right there from Vatican City, behind those walls. The walls that, you know, you in America aren't allowed to have to keep out the heathens. Ha ha, what hypocrites. And he calls up God, tells him what he got wrong today. If it's not obvious, I'm going to be really hard today, folks, on pagan, whoring hypocrites who lie, mislead the sheep, tell them that he is God and not the one who wrote the book for us, and that the things that are written down don't matter. Hey, without a priest, you can't really read that stuff anyway. It was that once upon a time in places like the book of Revelation by Yahushua called the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. What is it in a nutshell? Well, it's this idea that the laity, that's the peons out there, that's the sheeple, they can't possibly read scripture, much less know what it really says, without some whoring priest. You know, the kind that likes to get little boys, I guess, off somewhere behind the lectern. Ah, this stuff irritates me. And I hope and pray that it should, folks, because we're going to talk today about a lot of things that are so in your face that if we aren't being beaten for the light to burn continually, we got really big problems. All right, let me see if I can get through these two verses without being overwhelmed with disgust at what's going on in the world and what is supposed to go on if, in fact, our hearts really do have his Torah written on them. Yeah. Don't kid yourself. Jeremiah 31:31. I quote this frequently of late. Read it. It says it'll no longer be necessary when the Torah is finally written on people's hearts for each one to teach his brother, saying, "Know Yahuwah," for they will all know him from the least of them to the greatest of them. Well, that ain't happened yet. It's particularly true among the fish hat wearing crowd that essentially say, no, we don't need that anyway. It's done away with. And you idiots couldn't understand it even if we let you read it. Remember that for centuries it was a capital crime in the Roman Empire. Among the Roman Catholic Empire, for the laity, that thing which I hate, to even so much as possess a copy of the scriptures. Then there was a fellow named Gutenberg came along, changed the economics dramatically, and all of a sudden it was almost impossible for them to avoid. So they had to change the doctrine just a little bit. But still, now you will still hear this pope tell people, oh no, you can't possibly interpret it for yourselves. And I'll go one step further and suggest, and we're going to do this today, if we go through lots and lots of the scripture that's written, especially the New Testament that, got rid of all that old stuff, we're going to see just how dramatically some of it has been twisted to replace the commandments of Yah with the doctrines of men, something that Yahushua actually warned about over and over and over again. Okay, so here we go. Back to verses 20 and 21, if I can do them. And you shall command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure olive oil, beaten for the light, to cause a lamp to burn continually, in the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting. Ohel is tent, and Moed, that's kind of a, it's a time of... You see it otherwise, Moedim, right? His Moedim, his feast. It's the same word there that means a holy set apart when you put the word holy with it, but a convocation, a meeting. His appointed times are times of meeting. And this is the Ohel of meeting. All right, so this is where this lamp is going to burn continually in this place. A physical place that was created for him to dwell among us. Yeah, there's an obvious metaphor there. In the tent of meeting, without the veil, outside the veil, in other words, which is before the testimony. Think about that, too. This place where the lamp is to burn continually is outside in front of the veil, which contains the testimony. Does that sound a little bit like the metaphor continues here? Well, in this place, in this Ohel Moed, Aaron and his sons shall set it in order to burn from evening to morning before Yahuwah. It is, says the word here, to be a statute forever. And that word there is chuk. It's actually chukat olam. A statute forever throughout their generations on the behalf of the children of Israel. Are we of the children of Israel? Can we be grafted in? Are we yet? Years ago, I got really upset because I saw a friend sent me a video of a so-called preacher saying, "Are you the children of Israel?" Hell no! Well, he didn't say it quite that way, but that's the intent. No, you're not of the children of Israel, for crying out loud. Has the guy ever picked up a Bible and read what it says there? If you're not, you sure as hell ought to try to be. To want to be grafted in, that was the point of Exodus in the mixed multitude. People like Caleb came out with the B'nai Israel and literally got grafted in. Caleb got grafted in to the tribe of Judah. That's a pretty darn good thing. That's a wonderful thing. We ought to aspire, in other words, to be of the children of Israel. And the point here is that this light from these beaten olives is to cause a lamp to burn continually. When? Well, from evening to morning. Evening to morning. What is that? Well, that's a period of darkness, isn't it? There ought to be oil beaten for light burning continuously from morning. Nope. During the period of darkness, from evening until morning. Does that sound a bit like a metaphor that might just be appropriate today too? Yeah. During a period of darkness, on behalf of the children of Israel, and this is a statute forever throughout their generations. Well, we don't have the tent of meeting. Now, one of the things that I'll frequently point out is, well, you know, when there is not a Mishkan, there's not a tabernacle, there are certain things, certain sacrifices that we can't make. Hey, maybe there are other ways. We can't have this pure beaten olive oil in the menorah, in the holy area in front of the tent of meeting, outside that area, before the testimony. We don't have any of that physical stuff today. We've been told that the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is supposed to be within us, great. And in some cases, I don't doubt that there are people, may we be among them, about which this can be said. It's certainly not the general situation. It's certainly not the situation among most of those who don't even bother to keep his Moedim, his appointed times, and don't have the lamp of his Torah, which is supposed to be a lamp to our feet, right? I think King David wrote that in the Psalms. Your Torah is a lamp to my feet. I'm going to come back to this word Torah and law, too, because I think it's real important. Most of you already know the answer there, but it's interesting to show, and we'll go through a bit of that, just how much twisting has gone on. Evening to morning, during periods of darkness, this is to be a chukat olam, a statute forever on behalf of the B'nai Israel. If the children of Israel, the 10 lost tribes in particular, have been scattered throughout every nation, tribe, and people on earth, and they in many cases don't even know who they are, how, I guess, much more important is it for those who can be beaten for light to shine from evening to morning as a statute forever of the Holy of Holies that at least some of us claim is within us. If the law is in our hearts, if the testimony is in our hearts, that ought to be true. And I'll say it as bluntly as I can. If somebody tells me that the Torah has been done away with and that the law is written on their hearts, I'll tell you he's a liar and the truth is not in him. Let God be true and every man a liar, especially if they claim things like that, and then do exactly what Yeshua in his first public address said don't do. Teach others to violate the least of these commandments and do so themselves. In other words, folks, for a long, long time, 17 centuries plus, we've been told things by a lying so-called church that his appointed times, the Jewish feast, you know, Jewish, bad. No, it's not. He says over and over again throughout Torah, these are my feast, my Moedim. Keep them forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places, even when you're scattered throughout the world because of your whoring. Do these things. What did the so-called church say throughout much of the Dark Ages? If you Judaize, we'll kill you. It was the purpose of the office of the Inquisition. Hey, wasn't the last pope, Benedict? That was his essentially executive position prior to coming to the popeliness and putting on the Dagon fish hat. But you know what? All of that pales in comparison to the evil that is literally rampant today. I was going to do the news later, but I'm going to at least mention a couple things because I'm sure everybody already knows them. We had a Supreme Court justice, literally. I'm going to just come right out and say it. Was he murdered? Was it natural causes? Well, it sure as hell stinks to high heaven because, again, if a dog catcher in a Texas county was to die anywhere without a medical examiner or someone qualified in medicine to certify that he died of natural causes, there was supposed to be an inquest. How about if there's a very, very high public official that dies in a really suspicious circumstance, which is basically any time when a high public official who doesn't have his protection detail around him dies and then is found with a pillow over his face? That's not suspicious. Well, I guess you can kill somebody on Dealey Plaza with a magic bullet and get away with that, too. But at least when they executed John Kennedy, they had a massive cover-up. You know, it took people in the Warren Commission, most of whom ended up being senators and or presidents, to pull that one off. And they even faked an autopsy. Well, what about now? It's a lot easier. We don't even have to fake the autopsy. We don't even bother with it. Hell, we can kill anybody we want, and that's the message here. Talk about lawlessness. Talk about a nation wherein there is no fear of Yahuwah, and where do not murder means no, we will murder anybody we want with impunity. All they're doing here is essentially just saying, hey, remember a couple years ago when in the dark of night, Barry Sotero signed the NDAA? National Defense Authorization Act says we can kill you, just like the old emperor in the Roman Empire, thumbs up, thumbs down. Don't need no stinking evidence, don't need a warrant, don't have a right to due process, much less to face the accuser or even see the evidence presented against you in a court of law. We can kill people, and they have been. I got just two words for you, predator drone. Well, that was then, when people like Lavoie Finicum needed to be worried about getting executed on a roadside out in the middle of Oregon and in front of nothing except so-called law enforcement who can kill with impunity. And now they've done it to a Supreme Court justice. And furthermore, they're sending a message. They're sending a message to everybody with eyes to see. I'm thinking if I was a Clarence Thomas, he's too smart of a man not to realize the message that's being sent here. The only thing that's missing, and I've said this all week long, from this scene is a horse's head in the bed.
Gotta make him an offer. He can't refuse.
And they did. We're at a place where the lawlessness has gone so far over the top that, we had a pope this week. And I suspect most of you have heard this. Give me some ones if you heard about the pope basically interfering in the U.S. election process. First time in the history, at least of the modern popehood. Certainly throughout the great majority of the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church appointed kings. And the point of the Jesuits, as most people are aware, was to be able to dispatch kings to, the eternal hell that they said awaited them if they failed to obey the orders of the Roman pontiff with impunity. So they have a history of interfering in national affairs. But this is at least the most blatant time that they've ever come right out. And essentially the Catholic Pope on the border between Mexico and the United States this last week said that Donald Trump isn't a Christian because he dared to build a wall. And he thinks the United States has the right to prevent the Muslim hordes or anybody else that doesn't meet the lawful requirements, as if we still had a law, from coming in. And this is from the same guy who was just in Cuba and didn't have a problem with the communist regime there preventing people from leaving. Hey, how about that? Castro had a real, let's just say, public issue for years. People that wanted out of that communist regime weren't allowed out. We didn't hear this pope saying a word about that. No, that's fine. But when it comes to Muslim hordes and ISIS and other terrorists and drug dealers and anybody else wanting to come in across the southern border, he says if you build a wall, that violates the gospel of the Roman Catholic Church. Funny, though, as many have pointed out, this particular hypocrite lives behind the biggest wall in Europe, 39 feet tall, surrounding the 109 acres of Vatican City and preventing anybody that they don't want from coming in. They, in fact, have the strictest immigration laws in the entire world, in the so-called nation-state of the Vatican. And what's really funny, of course, is the wall was built up centuries ago to keep out the Muslim invaders of that era. So the hypocrisy here is beyond belief. But again, the point I want to try to make, and I'm going to try to make it as many ways as I can today, is that what we're seeing here is not just hypocrisy, but it's literally lawlessness that is writ large. I think it was funny, after the Pope made this statement, and all kinds of people essentially said, you've got to be kidding me, what hypocrisy. Even a very, blatant leftist, Katie Hopkins, writing for the Daily Mail in the UK, in their op-ed pages, essentially said she doesn't care much for religion, period, or anything of God, but, quote, if the Pope is so keen on tearing down walls, he could start with the wall of silence that's protected perverted priests for decades, which is a pretty darn good point. So I guess, one of the things on my list today is to talk about some of the places, and there are many, many, Mark chapter 7, Matthew chapter 23 in particular, where you see over and over and over again, Yahushua says, you scribes, you Pharisees, hypocrites, you do all of this stuff. Yeah, Pope, Mr. Fish Hat wearing, pagan worshiping, Ishtar sun god day keeping, so-called leader, vicar of Christ. Well, I'll tell you one thing, it is not the Mashiach. That's for damned sure. Let's just not mince words here today. Anytime somebody stands up and essentially says we can do things that the Bible, the scripture that we don't want to read anyway, you're not allowed to read it, absolutely positively forbids, like mixing the clean and the unclean, like priests who fail to teach the difference between the clean and the unclean, and who get little boys and little girls in rooms and rape them besides, and will protect that, all the while telling you, you're not even allowed to read this Bible for yourself. A doctrine that Yahushua, the one that they claim to be the vicar of Christ for, says he hates. I will suggest one and only one thing. Whatever entity these pagans serve, it is absolutely positively not Yahuwah. They won't use the name. And it isn't Yahushua HaMashiach either. Because his doctrine, his word, isn't welcome. And they have twisted it and lied about it and literally hidden the things that would expose that big lie for a long, long time. What is so funny about today, and the reason why I'm on this particular tirade, is because the gloves are clearly off. I think they've been removed for a long time. That velvet glove that hides the iron fist of tyranny has been removed. But with the execution of a sitting Supreme Court justice, with the war on cash, with 350,000 troops from Saudi Arabia and Turkey set to invade Syria, I think the only thing they're trying to work out is, who are they going to say we're fighting? Whose terrorists are fighting which other terrorists? It's not clear. We gotta do some PR work before we unleash the dogs of war on that area. Well, they've already been unleashed. Before we admit to the generally dumb public that we're really pulling out the stops for World War III. But with the exception of that particular pause, the rest of the stops for war against everything that is scriptural, everything that might be called truth, justice in the American way, everything that would have been once upon a time called the rule of law, is literally out of the cage. It doesn't get any more blunt than this. Okay, let's go back and pick up with the concept of the Torah, the Mishkan, some of the things that I want to start with, and then I'm going to go into the Haftorah for today too, because that helps to make all of this stuff clear. We talked first about the first two verses in the Parsha. You command the children of Israel to bring pure olive oil beaten for a light, which is to burn continually in the Ohel Moed, outside the veil before the testimony. And wow, there's that metaphor again. Lots of spiritualization here. This is to be done on behalf of B'nai Israel, the children of Israel. And you know what? A lot of those people are out there. They just don't know who they are. They've been scattered, right? The rest of the Torah portion, kind of following on with Terumah from last week, where we talked about the furniture and the architecture. Well, this week, the rest of the Torah portion talks about things like the servants. In particular, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. The office of the Kohanim, and in particular, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And the garments, that's the first thing that's described in detail here. The set-apart garments that they are to wear for splendor and for beauty. Lots of interesting stuff about that, but all of it, and this is where I'm going to just kind of summarize things, is to reflect, to remind them, and I will suggest to remind us, about a set of parallels. And I spent some time talking about this last night too, probably not as much as it deserves, but at least a little bit. This idea that there's a reminder here of Sinai. If you didn't hear that or haven't heard it yet, and I give credit once again too, even if I'm just going to do it briefly, Rabbi David Foreman and others, of course, have made this connection, including the Rambam, that there are lots and lots of things. If you will go through and compare what happened at Sinai and who was where the players were, if you compare the architecture, the similarities, the words even, you'll see that there are a lot of things that essentially show these bookends. Mount Sinai and what happened there is a lot like the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and what happened there, and what I guess ought to be happening within us. Mount Sinai, of course, was the mountain, top of which was covered with a cloud of smoke and fire. Who was to go up the mountain to the top? Answer, just one person, Moshe. Further down the mountain, there were some areas where other Kohanim, some of the elders, were allowed. Just like in the Holy of Holies, Kadesh Kodeshim, inside the inner part of the Mishkan, only Moshe and the high priest, Aaron, were to go in there. Outside of that area, the area that was called holy, well, the Kohanim, the other priests, could go in there, and outside of that was a courtyard where everyone could go. They needed to clean themselves up a bit. And if you look at the picture of Sinai, you see the same kind of a thing. Around the bottom of the mountain, there was a place where the Kohanim could be, but then around that was a place where everyone could go as well. The Torah even kind of takes this little left turn or an interlude, because the part of the story, the narrative of the book of Exodus, shows Moshe heading up the mountain. And then all of a sudden we get this digression about all of those whose hearts are willing, going to bring an offering, and we're going to build something. Going to build something together, this Mishkan, this tabernacle. All of those whose hearts were willing gave of the things that Yah in turn had given to them to build something together. And this is inserted in the story between the time when they all hear and indeed see the thunderings on Mount Sinai. What was their response? Well, this is really scary stuff. Hey, Moses, why don't from now on out you all just talk to us yourself, and we can't handle that anymore. If Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh speaks to us again, we're afraid we might die. And then the next time we return to the narrative, what are we seeing? People dance around the golden calf. Moshe gets upset. He smashes the tablets. Idolatry. And in between here is the thing which, when they build it together, literally will be a place where he can dwell among them in spite of their whoring and their idolatry. Does all of that begin to kind of fill out the picture of this thing which is supposed to bring us together? We've been told that it's in us. The Holy of Holies is within us. I will suggest that that remains to be seen. And the key word there is seen. By your fruits, let it be known whether or not that's true or not, whether the Torah is written on your hearts or not. And for sure, if you are violating his instruction and teaching others to do so, well, again, bluntly, there may be a spirit in there, but it sure as hell ain't holy. The Rambam pointed out that the Mishkan, Rambam's, of course, Rabbi Maimonides, and he was credited with making these observations originally about the Mishkan, the tabernacle, that that essentially what the Mishkan was kind of a portable Mount Sinai, a reminder. And along with the architecture, the servants, the garments, all of those things, it reminds us of Sinai, reminds us of the good stuff and also what we did that was wrong. And essentially what you'll hear various of the sages say is, oh, the Mishkan is just one way of making Sinai portable. There are others. There are others. Well, that's really interesting. There ought to be. And if, in fact, it ever is written on our hearts, well, that's another way of making it portable. There are certainly other parallels that we could discuss, but we got other things we're going to talk about today instead, including, let's go to two places. Let me conclude at least with one more verse from not quite the very end, but close to the end of the Torah portion of Tetzaveh this week. This comes from, in fact, chapter 29, the end of chapter 29, where it says, talking about this lamp again, isn't that interesting? Where there's going to be offerings in the morning and the evening for a sweet savor made by fire unto Yahuwah. There'll be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tent of meeting before Yahuwah. There, he says, I will meet with you to speak with you there. Wouldn't it be neat if, in fact, one of the ways of making Sinai portable would be to allow him into our hearts and to do those things? Great. I will sanctify, he says, that tent of meeting and the altar. Oh, same thing goes for Aaron and his sons. I will set them apart, sanctify them to minister to me in the priest's office. And I will dwell among the B'nai Israel, and I will be their Elohim. And he did. But as we also know, history says they committed whoring, not just once, but multiple times. And they were cast out. They were exiled. They were shellacked. There's a Hebrew word, Englishized. They were put away for cause, for their whoring, for their idolatry, their adultery. He continues to tell us the remedy, return to me, make teshuvah. Here's the message, verse 46. And they shall know that Ani Yahuwah Eloheke, Elohekem, their God. And they shall know that I am Yahuwah Elohechem, who brought them out of the land of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. And then he says it again, Ani Yahuwah Elohechem. From here, what I want to do is go to the Haftorah that goes with this week. Not the whole thing. Just in case you're curious, it runs from Ezekiel chapter 43, from verse 10 to essentially the end of the chapter, verse 27. And what it says here, and the reason why, of course, this goes with this week's Torah portion, is because it's about the temple, the dwelling place, they say, of the Lord. I'm going to say what his real name is, because if we're going to go into his house, we ought to at least know that he uses the words, or the tetragrammaton, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, as an indicator of who he is. He keeps telling us, Ani Yahuwah, Ani Yahuwah, and we expect his dwelling place to be within us, but we don't even use his real name. We paganize that. The prophet Ezekiel says, after that he brought me to the gate that faces towards the east, and behold, the glory of the Elohim of Israel came from the east. His voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. Then he goes on to describe the vision, the appearance of what he saw, and how the Spirit lifted him up and brought him in to the inner court. And behold, the glory, the Shekinah of Yahuwah filled that temple. And he says some things, and I'm going to basically say, well, the point here is that the prophet is told, if they're ashamed of all that I've done, and it would seem that they are, because they've hidden his name, and not just then, of course, but now the same thing is true, right? Look around the world. His law, his instruction, his statutes, judgments, commandments can't be taught in schools anymore. They're sure as hell not welcome at the courts, or what now passes for courts, in literally anywhere in the world, and so forth. if they are ashamed of all that they have done? Oh, well, now that puts, I actually kind of misread it, but with a point there. They seem to be ashamed of him today. He talks about a time when if they are ashamed of what they have done. Now that's funny, isn't it? Because we know that there was a point in time at which the people of Israel or the people of Judah have been ashamed of the things that they've done, of their whoring. I'm going to suggest that ain't now, folks. Look at the guy with the fish hat. He sure as hell isn't ashamed of what they've done. They're proud of it. They're reveling in it. They're rubbing people's noses in the murders, in the idolatries. They've got their priests and prophets in Hollywood. They have the sacrament of holy abortion that is spread throughout the land and subsidized at the public trough. They have the sacrament of sodomy that is now licensed throughout the land. And if you don't obey that particular sacrament, well, guess what? You don't get to buy or sell already. Mr. Photographer, Mr. Wedding Cake Baker, Mr. Movie Maker, you'll be blackballed. What was that guy's name? Back in the 40s? Senator McCarthy? They're really upset that he blackballed people. But not that they blackball people today. If they dare to talk about the creator of the universe or how his sacraments of gay sex or various kinds of idolatry or abortion or whatever it may be next is wrong. So we're talking about a future time here, obviously, even though it has happened in the past. The creator says to the prophet, and if they are ashamed of all that they have done, would that we live to see that. Make known to them the design of the temple and its arrangements, its exits, its entrances, the entire design, all of its ordinances, its forms, and all of its Torah, all of its instructions. Write it down in their sight so that they may keep the whole design and all of its ordinances to perform them. All right, that's the introduction. Where I'm headed and where I want to spend a few minutes at least kind of laying out everything that follows from here on today is verse 12. And I'm going to read it in English from the, the New King James. And then I'm going to go back and read it, what it really says in the Hebrew. Because I think that really points out one of the other things I want to talk about today, which is the meaning of words and how sometimes, even though the meaning isn't necessarily wrong in the English translation, at best, it's incomplete, that there's a whole lot more here than meets the eye or meets the English. It says in the New King James, this is the words in red, mind you, quote, "This is the law of the temple. The whole area surrounding the mountaintop is most holy. Behold, this is the law of the temple." Okay, now what's it really say in the Hebrew? Zot Torot Habet Al Rosh Har. Let's pause just right there. And even the first two words, first three words, are what's really correct, what's really important. Zot is the Hebrew word that means this, okay? Well, so far we're okay on that score. Zot, this, Torot Habet. Torot, Torot. Okay, well, that's plural. Instruction, Torah, Torot. This is the is probably a better way to phrase it. These are the instructions. For what? Habet. Habet, bait, bait. Beit Lechem. Some people have heard that word. Beit Torah. What is Beit means house. This is the instruction for the house. And the next few words that say, at the head of the Har. Har is mountain. So I don't have a problem with the translation as the top of the mountain, the head of the mountain. The whole limit roundabout shall be most Kodesh. Literally, it's Kodesh, Kodesh. The word is kind of repeated. Kodesh, Kodeshim. Holy and plural version of the same word. Most holy. A lot of times you'll see that mechanism in the Hebrew represented when something is really, really something, it's repeated in one way or another. So what it says is, here is the instruction for the house. And it's at the head of the mountain. And the whole thing is to be really Kadesh Kadesh. And behold, it says, as if we didn't get it the first time, Torah HaBeit. This is the Torah of the house, the instruction for the house. All right, well, what's the point here? We got a question? Maybe the point will get to the question. Mark, you use Shekinah in reference to Ezekiel 43:4. Where did that come from, the Hebrew word kabod? There are a couple of words, and I don't have the Hebrew sitting here in the King James. It actually lists in the footnote Shekinah off to the right-hand side. So you're telling me that the footnote is wrong? Shekinah is one of those words that can mean glory, kabod, abundance. There are a couple in the Hebrew. So I'm not sure if I follow the question. So if I didn't answer, put that back up there. I will check and we'll make sure that the footnote in the side is correct. And it'll take a minute, I know, before you all hear the response and then have a chance to type. What follows in the book of Ezekiel here, chapter 43, is that the prophet lays out the dimensions of the altar and of the altar's hearth, and then talks about how it's consecrated as well. So similarly, we get some specifics about what's going on here. But what I wanted to emphasize, I've already emphasized. So where I want to go next is I want to talk about some of these words, because I think all of this is key, and it's part of how it is that we got to a place where literally the gloves are off and things are now so in your face that people have been, in many cases, just deceived beyond the limits that we thought would have been possible. And how does this happen? I've spent a lot of time over the years, especially over the last couple weeks, talking about words. Most of you know that the word Torah, in particular, instruction, it gets translated as law, and that's not a horrible translation. It's just not a very good translation because it's not complete, right? It's kind of like if I translated the word horse and said it means animal, or better still, if I said the word animal means horse. Huh? Right? You know that those two things, if I said that a horse is an animal, that's a true statement. Torah includes law. That is a true statement. Animal includes horse. That is a true statement. But not all animals are horses. And Torah certainly includes a lot of things. Words that I'll also point out frequently. Statutes and judgments and commandments. That do mean law, but Torah also includes stories. The story of the prophets, the story of the patriarchs, the story of the kings, and all kinds of people are part of his instruction in general. And of course, some of you are probably thinking, oh, well, wait a second. Ha Torah, the Torah, usually means the five books of Moshe. Right? But the word itself is bigger than that. So that's my point. When we start saying that words are synonyms, that law means Torah, Torah means law, that's wrong. But almost always, if you see the word law, at least in the Old Testament, I don't like that word either, you know that that's what's being translated. You can pull up an interlinear Bible, the Hebrew, and compare it. And we're going to do that in a second. And note that in the New Testament, usually the word is going to be nomos, which is not a very good synonym for Torah either, but it's a better synonym for law. The problem is something that I will refer to frequently as conflation. Conflation. We'll come back to that word. What that means is that there are a number of things that can be translated into one word. It's called a many to one by mathematicians. But it doesn't necessarily go the other way. Let me give you a couple of examples to make that point. One of my favorites, for those of you that speak Spanish, is the word hot in Spanish, right? How do you say the word hot in Spanish? I'm going to ask that as a question. If you know the answer, even though I'll be past it by the time it appears on the screen, to me at least, how do you say the word hot, H-O-T, in Spanish? And I'll bet you I'm going to get 60% of the people that know Spanish and that answer will say the word is caliente, means hot. Well, how about if I ask the question differently? How about if I said, what does the word picante mean? Picante. Well, that means hot, too. Yeah, but it's a different kind of hot. Oh, it means spicy hot. You have to change it in the English to kind of clarify. See, the Spanish has a word that literally means more or something different than the way it usually gets translated. So the word picante in Spanish and the word caliente in Spanish will both get mapped into the same English word. But if I say to you that taco sauce was really hot, and you have a good understanding of Spanish, you can say, oh, well, you're going to translate that as picante, going the other way. But that's because you know both languages. How about if you don't? Is it possible that there's some meaning that gets lost? And the answer is, of course there is. It's not uncommon when we translate between languages that they lose a little in the translation. And that's part of the point. I'm going to suggest to you one of the things that's been done, and I think we're seeing the gloves off now, some of that's been deliberate. There has been twisting going on. Some accidental, some deliberate. Ultimately, I will contend that a lot of that twisting has been done on behalf of someone who wants it twisted, has from the very beginning, Genesis chapter 3, if nothing else, because he's a liar and the truth is not in him. And there are a lot of folks that serve him whether they know it or not. I don't care whether you call him Old Scratch or Molech or Beelzebub or Ha-Satan or the devil. The point is the same. There's twisting going on. You'll almost, every time I talk about this, you'll hear me quote 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 15 to 16. The very last thing that's in Scripture that was attributed to Kepha, or Peter. And he says, in the writings of our beloved brother Paul are many things that are difficult to understand. And they are often twisted or wrested by the unlearned and untaught, as in fact they do a lot of the other parts of Scripture, unto their own destruction. He's warning against it. And he says basically this guy Paul, now he's quite the consummate Torah scholar. He knows his stuff. But sometimes he gets pretty deep. People don't follow it. And so as a result, it's easy to twist what he's saying if you don't understand two things. One, he is sharp. And two, most importantly, he knows the Torah backwards and forwards. And he knows precisely what it says. And he's not going to write something that violates it. So if you hear somebody twisting something that he says to claim that he doesn't mean that, you know who's lying. And a very good way to make that happen is with this idea of conflation. Let me give you one other example. Now, this one I'm not as fluent with because I don't speak the various Eskimo dialects, the Alaskan and Inuit and Northern Canadian places where now you got to be politically correct, right? Native American, Native Canadian, Eskimo, other tribes would live. But suffice it to say, I've heard it for years, that they actually have dozens of words that we would map into one English word. Snow. Why? Well, you know what? Because they live in a land of snow. Snow is more important to an Eskimo than it is to a Florida retiree on Miami Beach. If you ain't never seen snow, I've been down to South America, Central America anyway, and I've met a lot of people that literally say, what is snow? I've never seen it. I've seen pictures. I've seen it on TV. It looks cold, but what's cold? Literally, you go to Central America, you'll meet people who have never traveled outside their native land, who have never been in their entire lives cold. They cannot understand what the word cold means, much less what the stuff that they see in pictures that's white. What, you mean water can do that? Well, then how much more so a native Eskimo who lives up there and says, well, you know, there's certain kinds of snow that pack really nicely. Other kinds of snow don't. There's certain kinds of snow that will stay on a mountainside and you can walk safely underneath. Other kinds, you make the wrong step or you shout and it might just come down and kill you. In other words, folks, if your entire world consists of a whole lot of different kinds of snow, you got different words to describe it. Because unlike the difference between picante and caliente, where, you know, if you mistake, that's a really, really picante food and you think that means hot, oh, I'll taste it. Nope, it's not that hot. I'll eat a bite, great big bite of it. And then about 30 seconds later, you go, wah! Okay. Well, it's a painful realization that those words aren't synonyms, but it's probably not deadly. Whereas if you mistake the meaning of other kinds of words, it can be deadly. I'm going to suggest that whether we like it or not, whether we want to admit it or not, the difference between the word law and nomos and traditions of men versus commandments of Yah and his instruction, his Torah, literally means the difference between life or death. And most people aren't getting it. Indeed, they've been lied to about it. That's part of the reason why Peter warns about the twisting that's going on. Has been going on, is still going on. And I want to spend some time today talking about several words. I've already started with the word Torah. So let me go back there again for a second. I hope the point, at least as far as the meaning of the word is important, has begun to sunk in. Now, this is something I've talked about before, but not for quite a while, at least not in the detail that I intend to for the next couple of minutes. If you go to a number of concordances, now I had a discussion this last week, it's part of what inclined me to this discussion. Strong's, and you'll hear people say, oh, the King James translation is the only word of God. God preserved his word. It is without error, which is, pardon my bluntness, bull. There are plenty of errors in the King James. Arguably not as many as in the not inspired version or other translations into English, but it is not without plenty of errors. And there, more importantly, are things that are just plain left out of it by hook or by crook. Obviously, his name is left out thousands upon thousands of times. How can it be perfect if it tells us that his name, which he knows we ought to know, and there's places in the prophets where it says, they will all know, Ani Yahuwah. That was the whole point of Exodus. And King James doesn't even bother to tell you what his name is, for crying out loud. You expect you're going to be invited into his house or have him dwell within you if you don't know what his name is, and much more importantly, his character that goes with it, and aren't keeping his instruction, aren't letting that lamp, that light, burn within you. Before your testimony, these things do amount to something that's important. Back to Torah. So, where I was headed with this is I'm actually looking at the online version of Strong's. I've got several Strong's sitting around here. I've got a couple. One great big one and a smaller one. I've got a Vines. There are other concordances. In other words, other definition sets, dictionaries, lists of the words that are in Scripture that purport to tell you what they mean. And the key is, you know, they're more or less accurate in most cases. I think if you doubt whether or not what you're being told the word means is the best way to understand that word in the context of whatever verse you're looking at, go back and do what I'm getting ready to do right now. Look and see where the word is first used in Scripture in context and see all the places that it is used. Now, the Blue Letter Bible, you can do this with a standard paper concordance, but it takes more work. And since most of us are a little bit lazy anyway, it's a lot nicer just to have all of this stuff right here in front of you. So I like this. I can click on the word Torah in that verse that I just read, Ezekiel 43:12. Zot Torot HaBeit. This is the instruction for the house at the Rosh, the head of the mountain. And it'll take me right to this where it says Torah. It'll even pronounce it for you. You can click on the little button and it'll pronounce it for you. And it tells you the root of the word, the etymology, and it gives the definitions. Let me read some of those, and then I'll get to where I'm really headed here. Outline of biblical usage. They say, number one, means law, direction, or instruction. Okay. Well, as you know, I would have put those in a slightly different order. Well, an important different order. I think instruction ought to be first. And if you go down to part A underneath that, in fact, instruction is first. A says instruction or direction, be it human or divine. And then it lists other little sub-areas. Body of prophetic teachings, instruction in the Messianic age, the body of priestly direction or instruction, and the body of legal directives. And it includes other things underneath that, custom, manner, and also finally it tells us, oh yeah, yeah, it also means the law of Deuteronomy or the Mosaic law. And it doesn't say, but it ought to. It is also used as a synonym, in some cases, for the five books of Moshe, the Decalogue or the Pentateuch. And then it gives us a little bit more. This is what's interesting. The root of the word Torah is from the root yirah, which means, you ready, to teach. Well, that makes more sense. That's part of the reason why I say, hey, Strong should have put instruction first, because it's teaching. But here's where the rubber meets the road. Let's go down and see how it's actually used. For those that say the word Torah means law, law of Moses in particular, where is it first used in Scripture? This is really educational. First use, Genesis 26, verse 5, says this. Because that Abraham obeyed my voice. Oh, these are words in red, right? This is what Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is saying. Let me read the verse, then we'll go back and get the context, because that's really important. Because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, the Hebrew word there, mitzvoti, my mitzvot, my statutes, hukati, statutes, huk, plural, mine, and my torot, torati. What's he talking about? What's the context of this? The very, very first use of the word Torah in Scripture? Yahuwah appears to this fellow Abraham, and he says unto him, don't go down into Mitzrayim, dwell in the land that I will tell you of. Sojourn here, and I will be with you, and I will bless you, and unto you and unto your seed will I give all of these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swore unto Abraham your father. He's speaking to Isaac, Abraham's son. Oh, he is repeating the covenant that we've heard before. I will make your seed to multiply as the stars of heaven. I'll give you all of these countries, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Why? Here you go. Because Abraham, that's your daddy, you know, obeyed my voice. He kept my charge, my commandments, mitzvoti, my statutes, hukati, and my Torah, torati. Wow. Now, wait a second. This is long before Moses. But it's the context for the entire usage of that word. And you note that it's not the first thing in the list. The key here is that Abraham, his father, obeyed the voice of Yah. Obviously, he taught him, instructed him in quite a few things. He kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and now does it make sense? My instruction, the whole smash. For that reason, this covenant stands. And here we are being told that Torah means law and it's done away with. No wonder people say, you're not the sons of Israel. You don't even accept the promises that's here. And then people turn around and tell me that that instruction is written on their hearts. Let's just say I have some doubts when I hear it in that context. But yeah, several key things here. I hope it's really clear. And even the Strongs will make it so clear. And by the way, there's lots of other uses. Let's go to the second one in Torah. Next verse. The man of the place asked him, Isaac, about his wife. He said, she's my sister. Oh, wait, that's the next verse in the line. I was going to look at the next place where Isaac already has a problem. But the next place where the word Torah appears. Torot. Remember, plural, singular. There are other forms. You'll see those listed slightly differently in Strong's. One Torah, it says in Exodus, shall be to him that is homeborn and unto the stranger that sojourns among you. Now, in this case, law is not as bad. I like the idea of one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you, but I'll tell you what, it's better still to get it right. It's one instruction. It's bigger than just statutes and judgments and commandments. It's one instruction for you that is homeborn and unto the stranger that sojourns among you. One set of teachings. Exodus 13, the next place. It'll be for a sign unto you upon your hand and for a memorial between your eyes, that the Torah of Yahuwah may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand has he, Yahuwah, brought you up out of Mitzrayim. And so forth. The key is this word meant instruction before Moshe wrote the instruction down, along with the statutes and judgments and commandments and the other parables and stories, including the book of Genesis and the story of the patriarchs and the prophets of his time. And it was also true before Constantine claimed that it was done away with and the Sabbath is changed to sun god day in honor of Mithras. And it was done before every single fish hat wearing pope or priest or even president thereafter, including those that now wield the imperial pen and say not only can they do away with the law and your rights under the law, and for crying out loud, your God hasn't been welcome for years. Well, what's left? Not much. It's as malleable as the imperial pen and the weakly hand that wields it. The hypocrisy here is clear. And the fact that we aren't able to know the difference, to rightly divide the word of truth, because the priests have failed to teach, he says this, my people, the difference between the clean and the unclean, the set apart and the profane, the holy and the unholy. And we're at the point now where they don't know the difference between bitter and sweet or good and evil and so forth. Here's where I want to go next. A couple of forays into this idea of the words, because as I've contended for a long time, if you control the words, if you can lie to people about what the words mean, well, like, for example, shall not be infringed. Shall not. Shall not. Once upon a time we knew shall not meant not no, but hell no, right? Shall not means you just don't do it. But how many gun control laws are there that infringe today? They don't even know what the word infringe means, much less shall not. Answer, tens of thousands. Last I heard it was 30,000 plus and growing. Now you've got the imperial pen saying that not only can we infringe it, hell, we'll take away your right to buy or sell completely. And they're working hard on that. Starts with infringing one thing, and then you branch out. If you control the words, you can control the narrative. You can control the debate, and literally, as we've seen with the Romanized church, you can't read or study the Bible for yourself. It takes a priest to tell you what it means. Well, you can control the very thoughts of the people. And you can even get to the point where you say, well, we got this guy with the fish hat. He calls up God on the red phone, tells him what he got wrong today. And we might change that. Hey, we were so successful forbidding to marry when it came to the priesthood. Look what we've done with little boys and little girls all around the world. Ha ha! And look what we did with the right to own property. Priesthood might have been a threat otherwise to the almighty Romanized church. Well, now we control some of the most powerful real estate and property and mines in the world. Oh yeah, certain things have worked out very well. Again, if you understand that who's being served here is not the creator and author of Scripture. So let's go briefly. And this is something that in the past, yours truly and many others have certainly spent a lot of time on. I want to look at just the first chapter or two, or at least a few pieces of the first chapter or two, what I often refer to as the most twisted book in all of the Bible. And I'm speaking about the book of Galatians, the letter to essentially a pagan church that was coming out of paganism. During the time of Shaul, Paul, after the death of Yahushua and his resurrection, And I want to begin, well, kind of sort of at the beginning. This is Paul's letter to the former pagans at Galatia. As you know, one of the things that people will point to in here is, well, we don't have to have circumcision anymore. Well, that's not exactly what he's saying, but you're not even going to begin to understand that unless you understand the point of the letter. And my intent is not to go through the entire book of Galatians. We don't have enough time. In the past, when I've gone through this, we've literally taken, in the case of the last Torah Teachers Roundtable, well over a month of two-hour sessions to do it. But it begins like this. Paul, Shaul, a bondservant of the Mashiach. He's writing to all of the brothers and the people assembled, the assemblies, Kol Edat, the Kahals of Galatia. Peace unto you from Yahuwah the Father and our Master, the Mashiach. And then he goes on to say the following. Okay, who am I looking to talk to here? Well, turns out there's a problem. And that would seem to be the reason why he's writing. Starts in verse 6. And what's interesting to me is the people that will twist the words of Shaul and claim that he says something different than what he really says will ignore the whole purpose for which this letter was written. Isn't that funny? I marvel, says Shaul. I'm stunned. It blows me away, guys, that here you are already so readily turning away from the one who called you to the Mashiach. In other words, you're so already turning away from the Creator, the author of Scripture, His Word, and the one that came to you in the flesh. Instead, to a, and I like this translation better, for a reason I'll describe in a second, to a different Besora, which is not really another, but there are some who are troubling you and wishing to pervert the Besora of the Mashiach. Besora, Besora, Besora. Oh, I know what the King James says. Says the gospel. The gospel. What's the gospel? Well, that's that Jesus Christ, you know, the one that did away with the law, died on the cross for our sins. And so now we don't have to worry about that. Here, have a ham sandwich. Huh? I wonder, I marvel that so quickly you not only have turned away from him, you're ignoring his message, and you've perverted the very words too. Do I have a problem with the word gospel? Well, only in the way that we have been twisted to think it means something different. So if nothing else, this word besora here, and really what we're talking about is a word that means message. You can go back and look up. Now, we don't have the original letter, which I am pretty convinced was at least written by a guy who thinks in Hebrew and Aramaic. His thought processes are Aramaic and Hebrew. If he translated it or if somebody else translated it to Greek, you know, there are some differences. But there's a word that's used there. And let's see here. I got it on the screen. I'm not big on the Greek, as you know. Besora, besora. Well, I guess I closed that window. Somebody can check it for me. Agoria, it's a... should be in this page. Oh, well. Suffice it to say, the word really means the message. Besora, message. In that regard, it's a little bit similar to instruction. But a message is slightly different, but it's something which is communicated for a particular reason. I marvel, he says, that you're so readily turning from the one who called you to Mashiach to a different message, which is not just another one, but it is a perversion of the message of the Mashiach. The word, the Torah, the instruction made flesh. But then Paul makes it really clear that this is a problem, and it's one that he's going to right up front set straight. However, he says, if we, or even a messenger of heaven, an angel from heaven, says the King James, messenger. Oh, what's a messenger? Malachim? One who brings a message? An angel? One who brings a besorah? One who brings a gospel? Okay. Even if we or some messenger from heaven brings a message to you besides the one that we've already preached to you, announced to you, let him be accursed. Huh? Wow. That's pretty blunt. As we've said before, now I repeat, I say again, if anyone brings some besorah to you beside the one that you've already received, let him be accursed. For hey, am I now looking to persuade men or Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? Do I seek to please men? Well, if I sought to please men, I would not be a servant to the Mashiach. So I make it known to you, brethren, that the message announced by me is not according to man. I didn't receive it from men, nor was I taught it, but through a revelation via the Mashiach. What was part of the message? Well, let's skip ahead to chapter 2. He's going to talk here. Well, before we get to chapter 2, we got to get his introduction. You've heard. Once upon a time, I was in fact a rabbi among rabbis. And I persecuted those who were of the Assembly of Yahuwah. And I ravaged it. Now, by the way, I'm looking at a translation that's called the Besorah of Yah, the Nazarene version. There are others. You can find a lot of variation, as you might expect, in the way that these particular verses in Galatians are translated, if you will compare people who understand that there is a difference between the word Torah and the Greek word nomos, and the instruction, and a message, and a gospel, and a besorah. We got so much baggage here, in other words. And what Paul is getting ready to describe, I will contend, is a big part, and I don't know that there are many translations that really do it justice, to be honest with you, of this difference, this distinction. I've already made it real clear. Go back and take a look at it, and we will in a second. I'll look at Mark chapter 7. Let me turn to that, and I'll read through some of that. Because the Mashiach is going to make some of the same distinctions that Shaul is. Well, and Shaul, for crying out loud, ought to, right? If he claims to be a disciple, a student, a taught one, a messenger on behalf of the Mashiach, you'd expect him to say the same kind of things that Mashiach did. And the thing that he did very clearly was to point out there's a difference between the nomos of men, what they call law. I think about this in the context of America today. What is law? Well, I'll tell you one thing, it's not. It does not include thou shalt not murder. We, say the officers of the law, we can murder with impunity. You peons, on the other hand, can't. The law, once upon a time, said your right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But in New York City, don't you peons dare think you have a right to keep any kind of arms. We might just shoot you dead if we even think you have a gun. And by the way, we'll search you in spite of what the law says about illegal search and seizure and needing a stinking warrant. Law? What the hell does the word law mean anymore? In a land that has been taught, in a world that's been taught for 17 centuries, that the law is done away with, nailed to the cross. I mentioned this a while ago. Is there a court of law left in America? Is there a court of law left anywhere in the greater Babylon metro area? In the Roman paganized world? In modern Mitzrayim? Honestly, I don't think so. There may be in some places where his people keep his word and his instruction, but as far as a national government, a state government that actually keeps the law, one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you, I would be thrilled to be shown that there is. So the distinction Paul is making here, he says in his former life of what we would now call Judaism, Rabbinism, he persecuted the Assembly of Yahuwah. Because, he says, I was ardent for the traditions of my fathers. What they called nomos, law. They didn't distinguish between the law of Elohim, the instructions of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and the commandments of man. They called them all, nomos, law, just like we do today, and we don't even know what the word means either. Okay, on to Mark chapter 7 for some more background. The Pharisees, some of the scribes, assembled to Yahushua. They came out of Jerusalem, and they saw that some of his Talmidim, his taught ones, ate their bread with unwashed hands. They said, "Oh, that's bad, dudes!" Because the instruction here tells us all the Yehudim, the Pharisees particularly, did not eat unless they first washed their hands in a ritual form, holding fast to the tradition of the elders. And coming from the marketplace, they don't eat either unless they do that traditional hand washing. And there are all kinds of other traditions. And this translation makes a real point of making that word clear. Traditions, which they received and hold fast. The washing of cups and utensils, copper vessels and beds and so forth. And they ask him, "Your Talmudim, why do they not walk according to the traditions of the elders? They eat bread with unwashed hands, ritually impure." "Well," said Yahushua, "well did Yeshayahu prophesy concerning you, Isaiah. You hypocrites," he said, "because it's been written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain do they worship me, teaching as commandments the doctrines of men.'" They call them all nomos. They are conflating all of these things. They're saying essentially, "Oh, well, we call the commandments of men, the traditions, the things that we wrote, the halacha, the various commandments that we have decreed, we say they're equivalent to God." What does the Romanized church say nowadays? Well, we got the fish hat, and the Pope, as the vicar of Christ, is infallible, particularly when he sits in the seat of Peter. And he basically overrules God and says, "Here's what you can't do that God said you can, or here's what we say you can do that God said is forbidden, like eating pork. Fish on Friday, no fish on Friday," right? We have conflated beyond reason this concept of law, saying that the commandments of man are every bit as important as the commandments of Yah. Well, what did Yeshua say? "Forsaking the commandments of Elohim, you hold fast to the traditions of men. Well, do you set aside the commandments of Yah in order to guard your traditions?" And then he goes on and gives example after example. "Are you without understanding? Don't you understand that it's not what enters a man from outside that defiles him, but it's what comes out of him?" Now, what's funny is they'll take this very same example here about food, and they'll twist it and say, "Hey, see, thus he did away with the commandment of God." What a bunch of lying hypocrites. The very example that he uses to prove that they're lying hypocrites, they go out and twist it. "Are you that without understanding?" No way. No wonder he says, "Well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, saying these people respect me with their lips, but their heart is far from me?" Oh, the Torah is written on, no, the law is written on our hearts. No, what they're really telling you is, whatever comes out of our mouth is what's written on our hearts, and that is the law. And we will twist scripture any way we can, including denying you peons the right even to have it, and telling you that without our priests, you can't possibly understand it. Is it any surprise, then, that over the centuries, literally, this has been twisted to the point where if you control the meaning of words, you control the language? Paul points all of this stuff out. "Once upon a time, I bought into that lie," is what he's saying. "But now I realize that what is written," and he memorized it and knew it, "is not necessarily what it is we've been taught," because there is a difference in these words. So you take Paul's writings, you convert them into Greek, you take the word Torah, and you conflate that, the commandments of Yah, with the traditions of men, and pretty soon you got a mishmash mess. So let's go to chapter 2. Now, I'm going to look here. I've got the Besorah on one hand. I'm just going to compare a couple verses from Galatians. The very next chapter. Starsborg says, now 14 years later, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas. I took Titus with me, and I communicated to them this message. Oh, the King James says this gospel, which I preach among the nations. Well, the King James says Gentiles, goyim, and privately. And he basically talks about a problem. And the problem is, I guess, deliberately confusing. There were those that were saying that if you wanted to return to the teachings of the Torah, it was a prerequisite that you be circumcised. Now, if you read Acts chapter 15, you'll see that they say, now, here are the four prerequisites. Here are four things. Not eating things sacrificed to idols, avoiding blood, and avoiding all kinds of sexual immorality. Those are kind of the minimum necessary conditions that we'll use to get people cleaned up. And then what do they say? And here's what the church ignores. Hey, isn't the Torah taught in every synagogue in the land on every Shabbat? Well, see, they didn't know, well, maybe they did, that just a few centuries later, Shabbat was going to be outlawed, and anybody that kept it was going to be called anathema, and they were going to shut the synagogues down, kill the people that were teaching Torah. But at least at the time they wrote that letter, they said, look, here's the idea. There's four minimum things that we got to get you guys cleaned up enough so that you just don't defile and stink up the whole place by coming in the door. Once you got those things down in, well, you can come through every Sabbath. We'll teach you the rest. You can learn about dishonest weights and measures. You can learn some of the things that you ought to already know, like thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not commit adultery. You can learn the rest of these things. And here it is, just 1,700 years, well, after the Council of Nicaea, couple millennium, we've forgotten almost all of it. We've been told it's all done away with. That's because it's written on our hearts. We're no longer beaten for the lamp because we're no longer a light. The Torah is no longer a lamp to our feet, so forth. Circumcision ends up being kind of a, if you want to scare people away, I guess, you get guys that are just beginning to understand that, you know what, rape is not so good, and here is some other instruction that you may not have heard before, and oh, by the way, take out your, you know what, we got this nice sharp knife here, we're going to whack on you. You know what? Is it any wonder that they basically said, we'll save that till they're a little bit more mature, till they're ready to drink milk, at least. Maybe eat meat before we whack on their meat with a cleaver. What's problematic in here is that Paul uses the word circumcision and uncircumcision, well, at least the Greek and or Hebrew equivalents, to describe the difference between those people who were either Greek or not Greek, who were pagans or not pagans, who had or had not been marked according to the covenant of Abraham. So all of these other words, I mean, we don't have time to go into all the other words, but they too are confusing. What I want to focus on is the fact that he talks about Titus, who was with me. He was Greek, and we have others here who were not Greek and who are therefore circumcised. And there are people, because of whether they come from the circumcision or the uncircumcision, who have different understandings of Torah. They saw, verse 7, that the gospel, the Besorah, the message of the uncircumcision was committed unto me. In other words, I'm the one that is going to go out not and tell people they don't need to have anything, including their hearts, circumcised. No, that's not the point. Just that those who aren't yet physically circumcised, the so-called Gentiles, the goyim, the nations, those are the ones I'm going to go out and talk to, take the message. Whereas the message of the circumcision, those that are already understanding of Torah, well, they were going to be taught by that guy, Kepha, Peter. For he wrought effectually in Peter to the apostleship of those that were circumcised. The same was mighty in me towards the uncircumcised. So basically they agreed that. Oh, and they're all going to remember the poor. But Peter, Kepha, came to Antioch, and I had a problem with him, and I withstood him to his face, because he was not blameless. Because up until this point, he would eat with those uncircumcised folks, the Gentiles. But when the other folks came, then he became a hypocrite. He withdrew, he separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. People read this and they think the whole thing has to do with whether or not people are whacked. No, the issue is whether or not people are hypocrites dealing with the folks that they're supposed to be sharing the message with. Others that were Jews of the circumcision, they likewise did similar things. Even Barnabas was carried away with their dissimulation. But, says Shaul, when I saw that they did not walk uprightly according to the truth of the message we were supposed to be sharing, I said to Peter before all of them, if you, being a Torah observant Jew, live after the manner of those who are not, the so-called Gentiles, and not in the way that your faith teaches, then why do you compel those guys to live the way the Jews do? Ethnikos, the Gentiles, to live as the Yehudim. We, who were born this way, and not basically lawless ones, as those that are coming out of paganism, know that a man is not justified by the works of what? The nomos? Which nomos are we talking about here? Here's where the rubber meets the road. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the nomos, but by the faith of the Mashiach, we might be justified by the faith of Mashiach, not by the works of the nomos. For by the works of the nomos shall no flesh be justified. Well, wait. Which nomos is he talking about here? Do you see how it does make a difference? And it's important, too, that we understand that there is this whole message about grace versus instruction. Instruction is what we are taught. Grace, well, you can find grace in Genesis chapter 3. You see, the letter of the instruction, on the day that you eat of that fruit, you will die. Does he mean a day, or does he mean 1,000 years? Because they didn't die, evidently, on that very same sunrise to sunset portion. But nevertheless, Yahuwah kept his instruction, but he showed grace too. Because otherwise, there wouldn't have been the rest of the whole book. Noah found grace. We have been led to lies for so long by the twisting of all of this. Well, because the point here is to prove that that mean old God of the Bible can't be trusted, and that his word is done away with, nailed to the cross. And now we are no longer bound by the law. I don't have to keep the law. Have a ham sandwich. Don't worry about his stinking Sabbaths. You know, those things he says to keep forever in all your dwelling places throughout your generation. Hell, don't even worry about being a light to the world. Where did we start today? Pure olive oil beaten for light to burn continuously before the testimony during the darkness as a statute forever on behalf of the children of Israel. Is that done away with too? As far as the Romanized, paganized, whore church is concerned, you're damn right it is. That's how come we can tell you, look around at this wonderful world we have created, where little priests have their way with little boys and little girls, and we say it's great. And where we can kill people that actually think the law matters. We'll arrange them nicely on a bed as a message to anybody else who still thinks the law applies to you. For 1,700 years, we've been told by the liars with the funny pagan hats, the priests who fail to teach the difference between my Torah, my instruction, says Yahuwah, and their stinking commandments, traditions of men. We've been told the law is done away with. Well, look at the fruit of that one. Look at the kinds of works that they have now succeeded in accomplishing. They have created, literally, a hell on earth. And that fruit is about ready to be harvested, folks. This is where we are today. A level of nastiness and evil that I think most of us, even a few years ago, would have said could not exist, cannot happen here. Little by little, line by line, precept by precept, when the foundations be destroyed, what Can the righteous, the Torah observant, the obedient to His word and His instruction, what can they do? Answer, they can come out of her. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ. Well, wait a minute. Which Jesus Christ are we talking about? The one who did away with the law, nailed it to the cross? Paul called him another Jesus and we've not preached? Or the Mashiach, the Torah made flesh? You see, it does make a real big difference. Maybe that's why Shaul says, work out your own salvation. What's the word there? Yeshua. With fear and trembling. Because if we've in fact been misled, many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, didn't we do all this stuff in your name and in your name do all kinds of wonderful works and cast out demons and you name it? What does he say? Depart from me, you who are without Torah, you who are lawless. I never knew you. Which Jesus are we talking about? Which law are we talking about? Whose instruction are we talking about? Man's? Man's Jesus? Or the message, the Besorah, the instruction of literally all of those who came in His name. It's not about being justified even by keeping His instruction. That part is actually correct. You're not justified. Oh, see, because I kept the Torah, I can break the Torah. I can lie. No. If you love me, keep my commandments. Which of them? All of them. When? All of the time. You're not justified by walking in obedience. The fact that we exist at all is an act of grace on His part, of forgiveness on His part. But if we love Him, what is our rightful service? To be a bondservant, to walk in obedience to Him. This is not hard. As long as we remember that we have been lied to for so long by the meaning of words that we've been lied to about. Oh, foolish Galatians, says Shaul in the very next chapter, beginning of chapter 3. Oh, you senseless, foolish Galatians, who has put you under this spell? Not to obey the truth. I only wish to learn this from you. Did you receive the Ruach by the works of the instruction, the laws of men, or by the hearing of belief? Are you that senseless? Take a look at what the entire book of Exodus that we're working through now talks about. Yeah, there are people who, unlike doubting Thomas, can hear and can believe, don't have to have quite as much evidence as others. But essentially, the whole message of the book of Exodus is, look at this, look at this, look at this. See who brought you out of bondage by a mighty hand. Ani Yahuwah. And I hear people say, I'm not under the law, not under bondage. Well, the book says, those whom He has made free are free indeed. Paul calls himself a bondservant of the Most High. And yet he's not under the law. Which law? For crying out loud, it ought to be obvious. The law of men. If he's a bondservant to the Most High, he obeys his master. By definition, he comes in the master's name. He teaches what the master taught. His instruction. His Torah. There is no mystery here. This is not too hard for you. By the way, that's what Deuteronomy 30 says. I've laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing. Choose life. Hey, this Torah, it's not that hard. It's not across the ocean. It's not up here. It's not down there. You have to ask somebody else to go get it for you. It can be, should be, in your hearts that you can do it. I'm going to turn to that. I'll even read it out of the King James or the New King James here. Deuteronomy chapter 30. I do this all the time. I know you recognize it. But in this context, let's do it again. Is it too hard? Oh, Torah's so hard. Can't keep it. Nobody can keep it except Jesus Christ. Well, excuse me. Jesus Christ, if He did away with the law, He sure as hell isn't keeping Torah. You must be talking about another Jesus, said Paul, whom we have not preached. Oh, foolish Galatians, I marvel, he started the letter, you have so quickly turned away from the simple message, the Besorah of the truth. Chapter 30, Deuteronomy. It'll come to pass. This is a positive thing, and it's couched in a negative way. I'm going to start with verse 1. It'll come to pass when all of these things come upon you. Moshe, speaking to them, speaking to us. The blessing and the curse, which I've set before you, and you remember them, you call them to mind, among all the nations where Yahuwah Eloheka drives you. Does that apply today? You betcha. We're there. Hey, been there, done that. We're here. Speak to us. And it says this, and you make teshuvah, you return to Yahuwah Eloheka, and do what? Oh, real simple. Obey his voice according to all that I command you today. You and your children with all your heart and with all your soul. Hey, you think it's written on your heart? That would be included in this? All the things that Yahuwah Eloheka, he will bring you back from captivity. Oh, not under the law. Well, then you're still in captivity. You stinking fools. I'm not under the law. No, you're under a whole hell of a lot worse bondage. Is it Barry? Is it his popeliness Francis? Is it the guys who killed Scalia and covered it up? Which tyrant are you for? Which satanic vision is the one that's driving you? Not under the law. The hell you aren't. You're a slave to the very worst tyrant that has ever existed throughout all of human history. Not under the law. Those whom he has made free are free indeed. They're called his bond servants. Back to Moshe, because he's telling the same truth. When you return to Yahuwah Eloheka, to him, and obey his voice, according to all that I command you to... What? It's not done away with? Not nailed to the cross? No, there's another one of those big lies. According to all that I command you today, you and your children, with all your heart and with all your soul, then will Yahuwah Eloheka bring you back from this satanic, evil captivity that you're under. In some cases, so blind you don't even know it. And he will have compassion on you and gather you again from all of the nations, Hagoyim, where Yahuwah Eloheka has scattered you. Even if you're driven out to the farthest parts of the heavens, from there will Yahuwah gather you. From there he will bring you. He will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. Prosper you, multiply you even more than your fathers. And he will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants. What? That hasn't happened yet either, has it? Still something to look forward to. I don't need to be circumcised. I don't want my heart circumcised either. I'm not under bondage. I don't want that law written on my heart. Well, you made your bed, lie in it. This happens when those who are his return to him and keep his statutes and judgments and commandments, all of them, you and your children, with your heart, all of it, and with your soul, all of it. No matter where you are, he'll gather you to love Yahuwah Eloheka with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. He'll put these curses instead on your enemies, the ones who hate you and have persecuted you, and you will again obey the voice of Yahuwah and do all, what? All? Yeah, all of the commandments which I command you today. He'll make you abound, fruit of the land, increase of your body, livestock, you name it. It's going to be really, really good if you obey the voice of Yahuwah to keep his commandments and his statutes written in this book of instruction. HaTorah, and return to him with all your heart and with all your soul. Okay, now I started there. It really wasn't where I was headed, but it's so important that we can't skip it, right? He says, guess what, too? This commandment that I'm teaching you today and commanding you today, it's not too mysterious for you, nor is it far off. It's not in heaven. This is verse 12, that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it? Nor is it beyond the sea, that you have the excuse to say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us? Do we need a Supreme Court justice? Will Loretta Lynch mob, will she bring it to us? Will whoever Barry nominates next, will he bring us the law? Yes, he will tell us what constitutes marriage. And he will tell us who can be killed with impunity by the servants of the law. And who can't know. None of that. The word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. See, he says, I've set before you today life and good, death and evil. And that I command you to walk in his ways, his commandments, his statutes, and his judgments, to what? To love Yahuwah Eloheka. That's what it means. If you love me, keep my commandments. And he'll bless you. But if you turn away, you go to other gods, worship and serve them, I announce you will surely perish. I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you. We've heard all of this before, but we haven't been told, because we've been lied to by our fathers for so many centuries, that it's all done away with. That the law is what the word Torah means, as opposed to instruction. Things have been so twisted that we can read a book like Galatians and become convinced somehow that it calls evil good and good evil, replacing bitter for sweet. All of those things we're also warned about. I marvel, he said, so soon. This was written just a few decades after Yahushua, the Word made flesh, walked among them. And so soon, it's already twisted. How much more so, to use a wonderful Hebrew metaphor, after 17 centuries of being lied to and told that his Sabbaths don't matter, what they're Jewish anyway, and that instead what matters is what the popes and the priests say. And I don't care, by the way, if people call themselves protesting Catholics, if they're still keeping Sun God Day and ignoring his appointed times, well, one thing's for sure, the Torah isn't written on their hearts. I see the comment from Whistler on the screen. He quotes another place, 1 John 5, verse 3. For this is the love of Elohim, that we keep, the word in Hebrew is shamar, guard his commandments. And his commandments are not too hard, they're not too heavy. And he said it in other places too. Who was that guy, John? Again, folks, this is not hard. What seems hard is just because we have been lied to for so long. And look around today and see the bitter fruit of those lies. Things have gotten beyond ugly. You know, there's an old kind of disgusting joke. Coyote ugly is what the world is today. Where you can kill people with impunity. Not just peons like they killed Lavoie Finicum out there on the road. Not just Clive and Bundy, who dared to think that, even though Senator Harry Reid, Dirty Harry from Nevada, and his son and his other proxies and the Chinese that own the debt, even though they wanted those Nevada ranches, and they got most of them, that guy stood up. So what did they do? They rustled his cattle. And when people came and said, you know, we've had enough of this lawlessness, and you should give him his cattle back, they said, okay, we will. Well, till you're not looking. And then 2 years later, after they killed the Supreme Court justice, they arrested Cliven Bundy and this week charged him with all kinds of crimes. What were his crimes? Daring to say no to the cattle rustlers, impeding them in the process of their official duties. Does this sound like the same kind of lawlessness that we've seen before? I'll say it again. Is there a court of law left in the greater Babylon metro area, in the Romanized, paganized world of modern Mitzrayim? I want to begin to wrap up, and I'll take a look for questions in just a second, with a comment or two, because the question always boils down to, okay, well, how do we deal with this? What do we do? Where do we go from here? Well, it starts with, of course, understanding that if we've been lied to, and we don't understand the meaning of words, whether it's Torah as opposed to law, or shall not, as opposed to infringe, or any number of other things. Do not commit adultery. No murder either. No slaying. Well, I guess that means no slaying unless you're a licensed agent of the Almighty God of this earth, who can slay with impunity. Whether it's in a bedroom, down on a Texas dude ranch, or some guy on a roadside in Oregon. or anybody else that we choose to slay. We can whack off some heads in the Middle East. We can CIA train and arm those people and unleash them through the open southern borders of the United States. Then we'll get that guy with the funny fish hat who lives behind the most secure wall in the entire world, arguably, at least when it comes to a nation state. And we'll get that hypocrite to say, you folks need to let the same heathen that we built this wall to keep out come right on in and rape your women, destroy your children, and take your stuff. Ha ha ha. Why? Because we're communists. We're pagans. We hate everything of the Creator. We don't let His word be taught. We'll kill. We have for centuries. People who dare to Judaize, who dare to say that there are commandments that we can't change. We'll show you what we can do. Do we need any more indicators? Do we need any more proof of it all? So one of the things that we can do, that we ought to be doing today, and being aware of, I guess I'll say it this way. You know what? I haven't talked a lot about fasting and praying, but if this is not a time, right now, in America with a K, for fasting and praying, there hasn't been one in the history of this nation. Let me say that again. If this, today, this week, is not a time for fasting and praying, there hasn't been one yet. I'm hearing people, you know, thinking of, oh, well, how about Adolf? Adolf in the time of World War II, that was a nasty time. Well, you know what, folks? Adolf was in Berlin. That's a long ways away. We got worse people a lot closer today, worshiping the very same gods that Adolf did. And if you go back further, hey, George III, King George, the nutcase king, he was in London. You've seen the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson. You know, better to be ruled by one tyrant 1,000 miles away than 1,000 tyrants a mile away. I think it was 3,000 miles, but you get the point. We got more tyrants than that a lot closer. People who are, yeah, I see the screen, choosing death. Claiming that the law of men, whatever it may mean today, at least, well, you know, at 25 minutes after the hour, right now, that matters more than what the commandments of God that He says won't change as long as heaven and earth still exist. That's what matters. I want to read a few lines from something that was suggested just this morning, and I thought, wow, that, like so much of Scripture, when we look at the world today, that really does fit right now. From Psalm, the Psalms, in particular Psalm 144. It's written by that guy, King David, a man after Yah's own heart. Blessed be Yahuwah, my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle, my loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower, my deliverer, my shield, and the one in whom I take refuge, who subdues my people under me. Yahuwah, what is man that you take knowledge of him, or the son of man that you are mindful of him? Man is like a breath, his days are like a passing shadow. Bow down your heavens, O Yahuwah, and come down. Touch the mountains, and they shall smoke. Flash forth lightning and scatter them. Shoot out your arrows and destroy them. Stretch out your hand from above. Rescue me and deliver me out of great waters from the hands of foreigners whose mouth speaks lying words and whose right hand is a right hand of falsehood. Isn't it amazing how so many of the things that Scripture tells us then are just as appropriate now? Guess there really is nothing new under the sun. David's son seems to have understood that. I will sing a new song to you, O Yahuwah, O Elohim. On a harp of 10 strings will I sing praises to you, the one who gives salvation to kings, who delivers David his servant from the deadly sword. Rescue me, deliver me from the hand of foreigners, whose mouth speaks lying words, and whose right hand is a hand of falsehood, that our sons may be as plants grown up in their youth, that our daughters may be as pillars, our barns may be full, supplying all kinds of produce, that our sheep may bring forth thousands and 10,000s in our fields, that our oxen may be well laden, there be no breaking in or going out, no outcry in our streets. Happy are the people who are in such a state. Happy are the people whose Elohim is, no, not the Lord, there are plenty of those, whose Elohim is Yahuwah. May that be said of us. Before I get to the other things that I'm going to suggest that we can do, some real specific things besides the usual, the elements come out of her, because the question always gets asked, well, how do we do that, right? Lots and lots of steps along the way. Certainly one of them that I think is ever so important, key right now, is to understand the implications of what is going on in the world. No, it's not just World War III and the 350,000 troops massed getting ready to fight somebody. They're terrorists versus some terrorists, anyway, in Syria, with the intent, evidently, of getting Putin to do what he's threatened to do, which is to have to use tactical nukes. And that, of course, because Turkey is a NATO member, would bring in NATO, and everybody gets to shoot off nukes at everybody. And ain't life grand? Well, death, if we're worshiping the other guy. Ain't death grand on a massive scale? And guess what? It's a great way, World War III, that is, to cover up Civil War II. In America, and indeed all over Europe, they've pretty well succeeded in taking Europe and destroying it at this point, but it's not done yet. Got a ways to go. And, of course, Europe already has negative interest rates. They're working on that, too. The Fed is planning on it. I saw a nice story today that I'm going to go through just briefly, because all of this is part of the what do we do stuff. How close are we stuff? Now that the gloves are off and they're killing people openly, can't they go right ahead and do what economists have said is impossible for decades? You betcha! If we can have negative interest rates, we gotta outlaw cash and bring on the mark. Folks, it has never, ever, ever been closer. Literally at the door. Here's a piece that I saw on the Gold Eagle this week. Arcadia's Ciron wrote it. It's called, Can the Fed Go Ahead and Introduce Negative Interest Rates in the United States? And what are the implications? Well, there are some legal and practical problems, he said, when it comes to introducing NERP. And among other things, we know that Janet Yellen, the almighty master of creation and the almighty fiat dollar, was asked by a representative in Congress this last week, Patrick McHenry, about whether the Fed has the legal authority to make rates negative. Legal. We don't need no stinking law. We have no lawful authority to even exist, right? Pull out the Constitution. Read what it says. Congress shall have the power to coin money, which is to be gold or silver coin, and to regulate the value thereof. There's no power in the Constitution for Congress to delegate it, much less create some public-private partnership and let it do something which Congress itself doesn't have the authority to do, which is to print paper and call it money. So the Fed has no legal authority to exist. Can they make rates negative? Of course they can! Because who cares what the law says, right? We're in a lawless land. But she answered with the usual gobbledygook, after which she said, quote, I'm not aware of anything that would prevent us from doing it, but I am saying we have not fully investigated the legal issues. There's still more needs to be done. Well, there you go. This fellow goes on to note that the Fed has a staff memo. Yeah, there you go, staff memo. That constitutes law, right? It's dated August 5th of 2010. 5.5 years ago, but it just got released about 4 days ago. Well, actually, end of January. Says the following, quote, there are several potentially substantial legal and practical constraints to implementing basically negative interest rates, a negative IOER rate regime, some of which would be binding at any IOER rate below zero, or even if it was just a little below zero. Most notably, they said, now get this, they could care less what the Constitution says, because we have the Federal Reserve Act, which was unconstitutional, but since we got it, we're going to stick with it, at least until we don't want to. It is not at all clear, it says, that the Federal Reserve Act permits negative rates, so we have to have more analysis. Why is it not clear? Asked the author. Well, they've got some expert opinions, and it says that basically the Federal Reserve Bank, on behalf of a depository institution, may receive earnings to be paid by the Federal Reserve at least once each quarter at a rate not to exceed the general level of short-term interest rates. So, basically they say, look, well, you got this problem because negative interest rates imply collecting a levy from deposits rather than paying interest on them. Now, here's where I go back and say, this is why I'm doing this. It fits here if you understand how words can be twisted. See, a word means what I want it to mean, nothing more, nothing less, at least if you have the power of God. The phrase, quote, may receive earnings sounds like a privilege rather than a right. Hey, we're really good at converting rights into privileges, though, don't you know? But the Fed does have, they point out, aren't we clever, the legal authority to charge for service. Ah, there's the loophole. Yeah, get that truck revved up and drive it right on through there. Because they could introduce NERP in a legal form by calling it not negative interest rates, but a service fee. Aren't we clever? How clever are we? Answer, we will just convert something that we can't do into standard operating procedure. So, the Fed has other ways. We could call it other things too. We could call it, nowadays, a reverse repo, rather than an IOER rate, circumventing what the admittedly vague rules say that we don't care about anyway. Twisting the law, in other words, has become an art form, and we do it all the time. Furthermore, the Fed has a problem with their computer systems, but those can be modified. And, the fact that the beta tests have been successful in Europe, some European sovereign bonds already have negative yields. They have blazed the trail for us, so we know that we can do it, too. We'll just implement the things and avoid the pitfalls that have already been scoped out for us. The conclusion of this author is, can the Fed introduce NERP? Of course they can. In times of crisis, even if it's manufactured, there's always the political will to do whatever needs doing, and all these changes will be made. He points out that at least in the short term, this is positive news for gold, negative news for cash, and that's why we had all the stories this week from Larry Summers to the European Central Bank talking about outlawing and quitting the 500 euro note. They want to get rid of the Ben Franklin. Summers isn't gutsy enough yet to say outlaw them. He just says quit printing them, create a paper-free zone, and maybe it'll be as successful at getting people killed or starved as the gun-free zones have been getting people killed. So we already see if we can create one kind of thing in violation of the law, we can create other kinds of things as well. And it's interesting how all of this fits together. Actions, things that we need to be able to do now. Well, I suggest again that if this is not a time for fasting and praying, there hasn't been one. If this is not a time to come out of her to the extent that if you haven't yet recognized that fiat is not money, currency is not money, kesef, silver, is kesef money. Here's another one of those words that the Bible uses, that people who literally have been dumbed down and lied to and told that the law is done away with just completely miss. They don't even know what real money is. Most Americans alive today have never used real money to buy a candy bar or whatever it is. You wouldn't want to buy a candy bar today. It's poison, as opposed to what it was 50 years ago when real money was real money anyway. They've never used real money. They've never seen a silver dime thrown on a countertop at a drugstore for a chocolate malt. And a real dime would have bought a chocolate malt, during the time when a real dime was a real dime. Think about that. If this isn't a time for fasting and praying, what is? If this isn't a time to get back to honest weights and measures and at least understanding, knowing what's money and what's not, what is? If it's not clear by now, folks, the wheels are not only turning, they're laying rubber, as the kids would say, towards killing the $100 bill, the 500 euro note, ending the ability of, if you want paper money, you must be a drug pusher or a money launderer or a domestic extremist. What they're not telling you, but the Wall Street Journal actually came out and admitted, is the war on cash is all about control. It's political. And by the way, it's telegraphing the Fed's next move. The fact that they're telling you this stuff means the Fed is planning on negative interest rates. You know darn well they're going to do it. Banning cash makes it harder for the peasants to keep their money. Because now you can force them to keep it in a bank. Who would do that if you're charging negative interest rates? Answer, nobody. So you got to get rid of cash too. And it's helpful if they're all disarmed so that when you take their cash away and force them to put their life savings in a place where you're going to steal it, they can't fight back. If you can change the meaning of the words, you can control the thought processes, well, you can pretty soon tell them you must take the mark of the beast because, after all, law's done away with, right? Forget that other stuff. There are very few people that are going to pay any attention. When push comes to shove, they'll hold out their right hand and say, okay, I need it. There was a story this week saying that the UN is already implementing stuff throughout the world. If you want the UN food programs, you got to have the finger scans, the mark, whatever it is they're going to say next. The beta tests are in progress. Decide if I'm going to do this one in a minute. I'll tell you what, I'll throw this article out there. If there's interest, we'll stick around and I'll talk about it after I talk about the rest of the Torah for today. I got a great story from Eric Peters. This guy writes about the car market. And he says, race cars are doomed because UNCLE, meaning the Environmental Protection Agency. And he tells part of the story. What I'll do if we have time in a few minutes is tell the rest of the story. It's just one more indicator, though, of the general point that I think has already been made. Big Brother is coming down with a lead foot and an iron fist on everything, and I mean everything that once would have been called freedom. Here's a story, too. Same point. I'll just do the headline. American Stasi. He talks about visiting communist Poland. Well, no, free Poland, but it was communist when his traveling companions were there. And she says the traveling companion who escaped from communist Poland a few years back won't talk to me. Why? Because I don't drink. What? Well, in communist Poland back in the day, booze was the first line of defense against the Stasi, the secret police. Quote, if they drink on duty, they might slip and reveal their secret identity. So they weren't allowed to drink on duty. So they wouldn't talk with anybody who wouldn't drink with them. Isn't it amazing how you see all kinds of cultural things influenced by police state things? And he goes on in this story to say, hey, look, you know, that was then when the Stasi had rules. And now in America, they don't have any rules. We don't need those stinking warrants. Big Brother doesn't have to listen to you at a bar because he can tap your phone and listen to your refrigerator rat you out. Not to mention your TV and your internet connection and just about everything else you got. All of it's recorded. Secret police got nothing on what's going on today. Back to the what do we do things. If you have what you think is currency and it's in a bank account, well, I'm not going to tell you how to invest because nowadays in a lawless land, of course, if I make a claim that can be taken out of context, they'll just come and say, you are giving investment advice without a license. No, I'm not giving investment advice. I'm just telling people that you ought to know the hearts of the crooks that are running things. They're going to steal you blind. They're going to take everything you've got. And you just need to know what's going on and take the appropriate actions. Do whatever it is that your heart in obedience to the Creator and His Word tells you you ought to do. But I'll simply suggest to you that what they call money isn't money. And what's in your account isn't yours. You already know that. And they intend to take it. Surprise, surprise, surprise. So knowing that they intend to do away with cash, what would the Torah tell you to do? Okay, question from Whistler, and this is a good one. It's still not clear to me, he says, how will negative interest be charged? Will it be taken upon deposit into accounts or on an annual average balance? Dot, dot, dot. And I say, dot, dot, dot is a great way to end the sentence. Answer, all of the above. You're going to deposit, if you're foolish enough to, let's say $1,000 into what you thought was an account. No, you're not. You're going to take what you thought was your money and give it to some bankster crooks who are going to tell you that, well, if they feel like it, they may just keep all of your money. Or as they did in Europe, they might do a bail-in. By the way, bail-ins are now the law in most English-speaking countries. They can just take. Because remember, the banksters are too big to jail and too big to fail. They literally can decide to take all of your money And if they're really, really feeling good on a given day, they might say, here, here's some worthless stock in the new restructured bank. You can't spend it for 7 years, but at the end of 7 years, you might be able to get pennies on the dollar. Aren't you lucky? So again, if you're foolish enough to put your money into a bank, let's say you put $1,000 in. How do they charge negative interest? Well, they say to you a month later, if you take it back, we've had to charge you a service fee, a processing charge, a value-added tax. Hey, we got a million names. We'll change the words any way we see fit. But you're not going to get back what you put in. Any way you slice it, it's a negative interest rate. Is it a deposit upon account? In other words, you put in $1,000 and they say, all right, you got $950 here. Wait a minute, I just deposited $1,000. Well, like I said, you got $950 here. That was a service fee for making a deposit. Oh, we didn't yet check your national ID. Put your thumb on the reader here, or put your forehead up next to the national ID scanner. Oh, yes, and we will confirm that you are, in fact, a servant of Caesar. And once that's ascertained, yep, you've got $950 right there. Don't expect to spend it all in one place. They can take out any way they want, anytime they want. It's not your money. They'll levy accounts. They can change the amounts, too, with impunity. They're above the law, right? Comment from No GMO Girl. This is good. The general public's not even aware of the possibility of negative interest. The general public isn't aware of the fact that the law has been done away with and that they don't have rights. They've got privileges. The general public will stand in line at an airport and walk through a microwave scanner and expose their children to being groped and raped and turned into little slaves of the state without a second thought. They have been conditioned, literally, like sheeple, to jump when the false gods say how high. What is it that the general public won't do? Answer. We don't know yet, because the limits haven't even begun to be probed. That's what the beta tests are about, seeing what will the idiots put up with today. They don't know about negative interest rates. Don't think for a second that now that all of this talk is hitting the press, the financial press that most Americans ignore, that they haven't fully planned for it and know exactly how it's going to be implemented. The only question is, when will they pull the trigger and pull that pin out of the grenade? Answer? Well, about the same time you see those 350,000 troops move into Syria. Or something else, some black swan, who could have thought this would happen, will come down. So negative interest literally is this, to summarize all of this. You put in $1,000, if you're lucky, notice I use that word, not blessed, because if you're blessed, you don't have anything to do with the whole stinking system. You put in $1,000, if you're lucky, sometime later, you get out $900, and it buys what $800 used to. And if you try to spend it all in one place, they'll call you a criminal, a domestic terrorist, a drug dealer, and a money launderer. Don't you dare have cash. Put it right back in that account because you're not allowed, you pee on you, to take it out. We're rapidly getting there. I can't imagine at this point how anybody could not read Revelation and see that no one will buy or sell without the mark and say, come on, it's all here, it's all done but the shouting. There really is nothing left to do except the final solution to implement it. And we know, by the way, that this will be announced. The peons will be told, and the peons will say, oh, that's fine. Yeah, we know who we serve. You know, I certainly want to provide for my family. God, the God that I know, Jesus, he's a nice God. He wouldn't expect me to actually obey. He knows that if I don't have food that I can't eat. So I got to do whatever I got to do. I'll worship at any altar to do that. Other commentaries. Okay, I think the economic stuff, I hope that is really clear. And we'll, I'm sure, come back to that. Because if there was anything that really stood out this week that was being talked about among the financial press, more than the execution of a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice, it was negative interest rates and the war on cash. And the fact that you've got, luminaries like Larry Summers and Janet Yellen coming out openly and saying things that they wouldn't have dared, words they wouldn't have actually even spoken a year ago. We're going to eliminate the $100 bill. We're going to eliminate cash. You will not be allowed to take it out. And like I said, even the Wall Street Journal, which ultimately is kind of a tool of the corporate state, admits this is really only about one thing. It's about control. Don't kid yourself. You know, why do they talk about money launderers and drug dealers and only criminals would want cash? Answer? Because they're liars and the truth is not in them. And they know darn well that everybody with half a brain is going to want cash as soon as they figure out that the banks aren't safe and that they're going to charge you for putting your money in a place that you thought it's safe where it's not. How stupid do you have to be to put up with a ruse like that? Answer? Who's going to want cash? No, you don't have to be a drug dealer or a money launderer or a domestic terrorist to want cash. You got to have a brain. And so they're going to tell you it's about money launderers and drug deals. And they're going to shut down the options that honest people have before they realize they've been shafted. Think of it this way. Who goes to airports and needs to be frisked? Answer, someone that we suspect of being a terrorist. Right? The law of the land says, no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. We don't need that anymore. What do we got? We have suspicion that you're a terrorist. That's our probable cause. You drug dealer, you money launderer, you terrorist, you. We can do anything we want to you. We can kill you along a roadside because you're presumed guilty. That's what's happened to the law. I'll say it again. Is there a court of law left in the greater Babylon metro area? The answer is no. You can't go to anybody and say, I want to sue because of what happened in an airport. I was deprived of my right to a warrant. Well, you were stupid enough to go to an airport. I was deprived of my right to own my money. Well, it's not your money. And what the hell did you put it in a bank for anyway? You should have known they were going to steal it and charge you interest, you fool. Well, I couldn't take it out because you said cash is illegal to have. Well, then you're serving the wrong God. Gotcha, gotcha, gotcha. It's not like you haven't been warned. So if it's not a time for prayer and fasting, what is it? If it's not a time for coming out of the money system of Greater Babylon and saying, I don't know exactly. Well, you do know. Scripture says money, kesef, is silver. If you want food in what's coming, don't expect to get it from Big Brother without having to have his mark. That has been telegraphed. It is beyond dispute at this point. The gloves are off. The law is dead. Stick a fork in it. And who's kidding who? Finally, there's this one. And I'm seeing it all across the country. In the last few days, I heard any number of stories about what they call an active shooter incident. There's an active shooter incident at a university in blankety blankety blank, somewhere in gun control central. Active shooter. Well, you know what they ought to call an active shooter? An Obamanist. Someone who knows that in the regime of Obama, the sheep have been pre-disarmed and ready for fleecing. You want to be a murderer? Where do you go? To the killing fields that have been prepped and readied for you. Get this. The same university that I heard this story, pick one, that outlaws the sheeple that are being trained to be good little slaves, good little rapees, had an active shooter, an Obamanist, on campus. So what did they do? They issued, get this, a shelter-in-place order. Repeat, there is a shelter-in-place order in effect. Shelter-in-place. What does that mean in English? Translating the words into what they really mean? That means stand there, very still, group yourselves together where you make a more ready target for the Obamanist. See, if you run, you're a lot harder to hit. But if you shelter in place, we can nail a bunch of you, you stupid fools. And for crying out loud, haven't you been conditioned? You do not shoot back. Sheep do not shoot back. Sheep are disarmed. Sheep do not have rights. Sheep have one purpose. It's to be eaten by wolves. At least so far as what they're being taught and told. Not only that, if the sheep do graduate from the disarmed killing fields, then what? Well, they're taught to be good little debt slaves forevermore. This week we had U.S. Marshals, armed teams, going out and picking up people, debtors prison bound, because of the crime of getting a negative education. You know, if you get a negative education, you'd think they would pay you, right? That's what Bernie Sanders wants. He wants to be able to negative educate all of the people and pay them for it. I guess that makes sense if you're a communist or a pope, because that's what we got. We got a world where everything's upside down. We teach people to be evil. We teach them that the law's done away with and that their God isn't welcome. And then we wonder why it is that they act like they do, because they've been properly trained. All right. Here is this article from Eric Peters. He writes about automobiles kind of from a libertarian perspective. Now, this is one of those guys obviously grew up as a gearhead, as the kind of guy who was probably out on a Sunday afternoon tinkering on his little muscle car, you know, his 67 Mustang or his Camaro or whatever he had. And he's been writing about cars and engines and regulations and the new vehicles and all that kind of stuff for a long, long time for various magazines. I'm sure you've probably seen some of his stuff out there in, magazines with names like Car and Driver or whatever it may be. I don't know. Anyway, he says, Uncle doesn't want you to modify your car. Now, some of this is old news. And that includes even if it never even gets driven on the street. That's what's new. So here's what's not new. Uncle Sam, in particular, masquerading as the three-letter agency, in this case, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. Those are the people that don't want you to have power or heat, too. Or water, by the way. They're looking to get rid of water. He has decreed, in his almighty godhood-likeness, that any modification to a street-driven car is illegal. Achtung, under the so-called Clean Air Act. Even, or especially, if that modification entails removing, disabling, or defeating any of the car's factory-installed pollution control equipment. And that encompasses every car built since the mid to late 1960s. First emission devices installed back then. But it goes further than that, he says, because it's illegal to replace any factory part that could affect the car's emissions with an aftermarket part, get this, even if the car's emissions are improved. They're not negatively affected, even if they're actually reduced. The question is whether or not Big Brother, in the form of the EPA, Achtung, has approved the modification. And this happens, he says, more often than you'd think, because factory parts are usually compromises. Well, look at the vehicle exhaust system. It may cost too much to fit that car with tube headers, so instead they use cast iron manifolds. They don't flow as well as the, you know, aftermarket headers that the enthusiasts like to put on. That decreases the efficiency of the engine. And so if you replace those manifolds with aftermarket headers, and you can replace the El Cheapo factory catalytic converters too with aftermarket high-performance versions, not only will the car run better, go faster, get better mileage, it also lowers the emissions. But it's still illegal unless these parts are, quote, EPA approved. Now, here's where I pause, because I got to say this, and this is part of the reason why I'm doing this. Eric Peters doesn't point this out because he's a gearhead and a car guy. I'm an airplane guy. And I was reading all of this stuff going, hey, private airplanes have been regulated not by the EPA yet. The EPA wants to get their hooks in them, too, but by the FAA for years. And they got the same thing. They call them yellow tags. They got all kinds of stuff. You cannot put a part on an airplane unless it has all kinds of expensive and voluminous documentation and is FAA approved. So literally, the EPA is just simply doing what the FAA has already beta tested. Now, why do I think this is interesting? And why am I going through this story from Eric Peters? Because what he is talking about here, even if he doesn't know it, is that Big Brother intends to do the same thing with cars that they've already done, beta tested, and pretty well outlawed with airplanes. When I grew up, folks, there were literally airplanes and airports all over the country, and every kid wanted to learn to fly. And every kid literally could learn to fly. And you could fly literally anywhere in the United States, unlike today. You could just get in a plane and fly. You could fly all kinds of places. And flying was cheap. And it was safe. Oh, we've got better equipment nowadays. Technology has advanced. It's safer today than it was. But flying was still pretty safe. Yeah, people could fly into thunderstorms and kill themselves. People can drive off cliffs, too, and kill themselves. So safety is always the excuse, but literally control, whether they like to admit it or not, just like with money, is the bigger issue. What's happened in the decades since I grew up, and I've watched it year by year, is more and more equipment is required. And the prices, not because they're better, but because of the regulation of everything that goes on an airplane has gone through the roof. And what's the result? We can price people out of the skies. What's the normal opinion that people have of a person today who has an airplane? Oh, gotta be rich. Well, not necessarily. Okay? Yours truly still has an airplane. My airplane was built in 1969, and hopefully it'll fly for another 50 years. It's almost 50 years old. 45, anyway. And it's a darn good little airplane. And because I do a lot of the work, everything that I can legally do myself, I can still fly it. But when the big parts need to be replaced, man, because they are FAA approved, they are expensive. And as I watch and see what's going on with Big Brother, you can tell what's going to happen. What's the problem with planes, really? Planes can overfly roadside checkpoints. They can overfly roadblocks. And Big Brother doesn't like that at all. They could overfly a state line boundary. If a road is closed, they can overfly that. Can't have that. I've mentioned this before. For the first time in U.S. history, just a few years back, matter of fact, the last time I flew out of the once free country, they put in regulations saying that for the first time ever, you had to have permission from Big Brother to leave the formerly free United States. Hey, does that sound like Stasi East Germany? The Iron Curtain, Cuba, you darn betcha it does. And you cannot leave, you cannot fly out of the United States now without Big Brother's permission. Wow. Once upon a time I joked about the possibility and people said, oh, that'll never happen. Well, now I'm going to joke about the possibility that if they can do to cars what they've done to airplanes, won't be too long before people will say, you got a private car? You must be rich. Back to Eric Peters. He says, all of these EPA-approved requirements have placed huge burdens on the aftermarket's parts business, which has to spend a great deal of money getting parts approved before they can be legally sold. Of course, that gets passed on to customers. It's why, once upon a time, these nice high-performance aftermarket headers that, you know, he and other junkyard or backyard mechanics used to put on, once cost under $100, now they cost $500. It's also, he says, why it's illegal, believe it or not, to retrofit an older car with a newer car's engine. Okay? Even though the new car engine emits far less pollution. For example, if you have a 1975 Camaro, it was originally equipped with a carbureted 350 engine without computer controls and a pellet style, I can't say the word here, he just calls it, let's say crappy, a crappy pellet style catalytic converter and no oxygen sensor, and you replace that, pull it all out, scrap it, put in a brand new computer controlled fuel injected GM crate engine with modern honeycomb cats and O2 sensors, everything with EPA approval, well, at least for new cars. You can't do it. It's illegal. You can't even have a muffler shop touch the car's emission equipment, like removing their catalytic converters and replacing them with better ones aftermarket that aren't EPA approved, even if they're better. And that's what can that shop can be expected to be SWAT rated. Yes, we have SWAT teams for everything now. Special weapons and tactical will come down on you. EPA goons, he calls them. Now ask yourself a question. We're in a nation that literally is in the middle of, whether it's admitted or not, an economic depression. Good old-fashioned car companies, aftermarket parts suppliers. Remember J.C. Whitney's catalog? All kinds of stuff you could buy. You could keep and you still can, it just costs a lot more. You could keep a Fliver, a Model A, or even a Ford Model T running with aftermarket parts. Nowadays, you get most of those, I betcha, from China. So it's too expensive to meet the requirements here. So for all the talk about jobs and made in America and so forth, here is the real reason, at least a big part of the reason, why so many people are unemployed. And why, furthermore, you can't fix your own car in your backyard anymore. That will soon be illegal. Where Peters is going with this, and I'm honestly not going to spend a lot of time on where he's going. He does in the article. He says, you know what's really important? Here's the real news. All of this has been going on for streetcars for a long time. But now, it's illegal to do this to race cars. Two. Race cars, track day cars, vehicles that are trailered to the racetrack and used only on the track and never driven on the street. No more exemptions or approvals. This, in other words, is the new news. Big Brother is saying we're going to do to, the race car weekend track market. Those aficionados that still like to soup up their 67 Mustang or their 75 Camaro and race them on the weekends, we're going to do to them what we did to pilots that like to fly their 1953 Cub around the patch on the weekends. We're going to price them out of the market. EPA is ratcheting up their enforcement octung of things that are not street driven. Vehicles that are trailered to the track, right? Modified cars, modified production cars. In other words, any car that ever came out and got driven on the road, there has never been previously emissions enforcement targeting because they are race cars, track cars. They're not driven on the public roads, only on the racetrack. They make up a tiny, tiny fraction of the total vehicles in the country, maybe a few thousand of them nationally. The number of aggregate miles that they're driven is infinitesimal. And when you put it all together, their total emissions are literally microscopic by dint of that compared to the rest of the car population. They're irrelevant, in other words, when it comes to air quality, but they're being targeted nevertheless. Now, he's not going to draw the connection. I will. Why? Well, because you know what? The number of people who care about race cars and production mod cars is tiny compared to the number of people that drive cars, just like the population of people who fly airplanes. Once upon a time, every kid wanted to fly an airplane. Once upon a time, every kid wanted to race his car and have a hot rod or a 75 Camaro. Not anymore. They'd rather play with their iPod. Weekend racers, in other words, are a small population. They don't have any political clout anymore. They did, but not anymore. And EPA, in its omnipotent, godlike wisdom, has said, we know you're not going to be able to do anything about it, so we're going to clamp down on you guys. The FAA did it with pilots. We can pretty well kill them. We can regulate them. We can tell them they can't fly anywhere. Right? If the president bats his eyes at a given direction, we'll shut down that airspace and you can't fly there. If some peon is gonna go have a meeting in a field, you can't fly there. If there's a baseball, I used to fly over Coors Field all the time. I'd take people out on a beautiful summer evening. I'd say, hey, let's fly down over the city of Denver. It's beautiful. You can see the lights. We'll fly over Coors Field. I would call the air traffic controllers and I'd say, there's a baseball game on. Yeah, Rockies are ahead 7-4. Oh, can we fly over the stadium? Sure. Make left circles and tell me when you're done. And we'd fly over the stadium. We'd watch a couple innings of the baseball game, listen to it on the radio, show people around. Thank you. And we'd fly. Oh, that's verboten. Now, you can't do that. No, you might be a terrorist. And we, of course, assume everybody's a terrorist because you have an airplane. Terrorists have airplanes. Terrorists have cash. Terrorists, once upon a time, probably had race cars, too. Well, it doesn't matter. There aren't enough of you that we can't shut you down because peons don't have rights and peons can't have hobbies. And you know what else? Here's the real point, folks. Eventually, we want to be able to say you can't change your car's navigation and driver control systems either. Peters had an article this week saying the new car is going to have auto braking. The car will apply the brakes whether you like it or not. Car decides you can't overrule the car. Even if there's something getting ready to drop on top of you, like let's say you're driving down the highway and there's an avalanche ahead and you need to get the heck out of there before you're buried alive. car's going to put on the brakes if it feels like there's something in the road, and you can't tell it otherwise. I don't like a car that won't let me drive. I'm old-fashioned that way. See, I'm a relic. Need to be put in my place. Yeah, re-educated. They got concentration camps for that kind of thing nowadays. The point, of course, is if you can't modify the emissions, well, how much more so when it comes to the auto-driving cars that will decide if you get to go and not just where you get to go? Remember, rub your hand, put your mark on the dashboard so the car can take you to where you want to go. That is, if you have the proper permissions. Another thing that was pioneered with airplanes was the idea that you can't travel without a clearance. Back in the good old days, you could fly anywhere you wanted. You didn't have to have Big Brother's permission, period. The reason for air traffic control had to do with, well, a collision over the Grand Canyon that was made a big deal out of. But essentially, it literally had to do with in-instrument conditions where you couldn't see. Maybe somebody else in there, you don't want to hit them. So they said, well, we'll make sure that there's only one person in a given piece of airspace at a given time. Okay, fine. That's not the same as saying, when I can see for a million miles, that you shouldn't be able to just fly. But you see, the point is, peons need permission. We need to control where the peons can go. We don't like them being able to overfly checkpoints, for crying out loud. And if the next step is to put in auto-driving cars that we can shut down when we feel like it, ha ha ha, or we can tell them, no, no, that car doesn't go to the racetrack, that car goes to the FEMA camp. Well, we don't want you modifying that system either. So it'll be a crime, of course, to do those kind of things. So, says Peters, you cannot vote out the EPA administrator. They're unaccountable. Or her legions of bureaucrats. They get to have guns, and you don't. And you know where it all leads, right? We've already talked about that. And pretty soon, as they move in this direction, there won't be any other options. I mentioned the American Stasi. I will wrap it up with this one then. This has kind of put the lid on it. Well, two headlines to start it off. I got the headlines here. Got to do the headlines. The Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, seeks to curb population growth. They've been pushing population control. These are the same folks that are, wanting to make sure that the women who they don't want to reproduce are vaccinated. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, with the proper kinds of sterilizing factors and other stuff. If we want to introduce anything into the general population, we'll use mosquitoes and or vaccinations. Who knows what's in it? Answer, you don't. Chipotle had a problem with E. coli. It turns out, as some of us were suggesting, conspiracy theorists that we are, now it turns out it's conspiracy fact. Yeah, they were targeted. E. coli was literally sprinkled into customers' dishes in any number of different states. It was called an incredible, unbelievable coincidence. Never happened before in so many different states. And it turns out it was only Chipotle and not any of the other food vendors in the same area that used similar sources. And after a major investigation, nobody could find out where this happened. But the only thing they do know is that it was immediately after Chipotle announced they weren't going to allow genetically modified Frankenfoods. They weren't going to put them in there because their customers didn't want it. And Chipotle actually had this old-fashioned idea. Our customers want good, clean, organic food. We're going to provide it to them, even in a fast food restaurant. Well, since you're talking a multi-tens of billions of dollar industries and Monsanto et al. Don't like people that don't like GMOs. Somebody took it upon themselves to destroy one of the world's fastest growing chain restaurants and literally hammer their stock. Cost people, well, close to $500 million in Chipotle stock. But at least somebody, kind of like with Antonin Scalia, got the message. If a major U.S. corporate business tries to go GMO free and provide clean food to people that need to be poisoned, somebody is going to put a stop to it. Reuters is reporting that an unidentified senior Chipotle executive disclosed that a federal criminal probe is now underway to investigate the sabotage of Chipotle's reputation and the deflation, the attack on their stock price, due to the deliberate planting of lab bred E. coli bacteria onto their customers' food. Now, let me tell you one other thing. Don't hold your breath for a federal criminal probe to identify the federal criminals that did it. Ha ha. Last piece of news. This one caught my eye, and this is how we close with, again, is there a court of law left in the United States? Well, no. What is law? Sure as hell isn't Torah, right? It isn't what's written in genuine print, be it the Bible or in the Bill of Rights or the Constitution. We got a Federal Reserve that proves that. We've got EPA and FAA and FCC and DOT and FBI and TLAs galore. You name it. We got a federal agency that's unconstitutional, that's doing something that the Constitution doesn't allow them to do. We got TPP, too. That's not a federal agency yet. That's tyranny, public and private. Well, it's also the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Did you know this? I actually just found this out when I saw the story in True News. Now, the story isn't what I would have put as the headline. I'll get to the headline in a second. But the story is TPP has been signed. Tyranny, public and private. Also referred to as the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, involves 12 nations, including U.S., Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. The group represents 40% of the combined world economy, and it was placed, get this, into full effect, they say, on February the 4th, just 2 weeks ago, during a meeting between trade representatives from all participating nations in Auckland, New Zealand. Now, once upon a time, to put something into full effect, according to what was it called? Oh, yeah, yeah, the Constitution for these United States, that would have required the approval of a two-thirds majority of the senators present. A treaty. Well, we don't have treaties. Remember, words don't mean what they used to mean. They mean whatever Big Brother says they mean. What does effect mean? Well, we don't call it law anymore. See, this is just an agreement. It's not a treaty. Ha ha! Aren't we clever? And therefore, we can get away with this. And you know what? If you can't buy something, because we won't allow it, well, doesn't matter whether you have a constitutional right to it or not, does it? And how about this? Here's the headline now. I think the news was they did it anyway. We don't need no stinking approvals to do it. But it turns out that the final version of TPP, it says, has covertly expanded, past tense, the criminal penalties for copyright infringement. Now, if you want to shut down free speech, how do you do it? Well, Twitter is basically saying we now have this control committee. We can shut anybody off we want to. We're a private company in public partnership. We can do that. That's what fascism gives us. That's part of it. But it's better still if you can tell people, you violated a copyright. You see, we copyrighted that song, that movie, that clip, that name. We copyrighted that story. You quoted an Associated Press story on your Shabbat teaching, Mr. Call. That is now criminal. You told people what is going on, and it was Associated Press that reported that. Or the Washington Times, or the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or the Amazon, or Google, whatever, or Yahoo, they reported it. They all have copyrights, you see. And now, Jerry Malcolm, senior global policy analyst for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has discovered that in spite of the lies that they've been telling us, there was a significant change in the final text that put back in something that had been removed, but it was all secret anyway, so who cares? Criminal penalties for intellectual property violations, copyright violations. Remember, you used to see those websites that get shut down, they'd put the Achtung message up. Heck, you can't rent a DVD without saying, Achtung, Big Brother ist watching und this movie is verboten for public display, even if it's not for profit. So the copyright is a major way of making sure that we can shut down speech that we don't like. What do? You just copyright it. Hey, guess what? I copyright the Second Amendment if I'm a Big Brother approved public-private partner, and I say you can no longer quote, shall not be infringed. Well, now if you quote it, we gotcha. Okay? Oh, that's an extreme example. Well, is it? So is everything in the news today. Anything that is deemed to be intellectual property that has been infringed, it shall be forfeited or destroyed under this subparagraph, says the new text, and this shall occur without compensation of any kind to the defendant. So if they find that you have a snippet, oh, let me do one here that'll just make sure we talk about what we're talking about. I like to quote the Wicked Witch of the West, right, from the movie The Wizard of Oz, late 1930s. These things must be done delicately. Well, that's a copyrighted phrase from a copyrighted movie. Once upon a time, there was what was called a fair use. Now, I didn't even play the clip. I just did my best imitation, or maybe an okay imitation. Okay, well, I did an imitation. But I quoted the movie. That's an infringement. Who has to say it's an infringement? Ah, let's read the next paragraph here. Competent authorities, says the text of the formerly secret, now supposedly in force, tyranny document, if competent authorities, it says, may act on their own initiative to initiate legal action without the need even for a formal complaint by a third person or a right holder. Did you get that? Some two-bit cop in the middle of Podunkville can say, Achtung, I heard you do that impression of the Wicked Witch of the West, and I'm going to destroy your computer and your tape recorder and everything else here. Looks like it might be associated with that copyright infringement under TPP, and I'm a competent legal authority. There's a word for it. It's called arbitrary and capricious, also called selective enforcement. The analysis that is cited here from the EFF said that the new text massively expands criminal penalties for copyright infringement. You see what they've done? Before, if you were infringing somebody's copyright, it amounted to this. Let's suppose you took an entire chapter out of a book that was published with a copyright by some author, and you did not give that author credit, and with a footnote, and you said, furthermore, this is my stuff, I wrote it. In other words, you pirated that copyrighted material. You committed plagiarism. You called it your own. Well, and you sold that textbook or that book for profit. Well, that's clearly an infringement of that person's intellectual property. You owed them damages. But that's not what TPP is saying. Anything we, some so-called competent authority, arbitrarily and capriciously declares to be copyright infringement, we can destroy or cause you to forfeit, quote, without compensation of any kind to the defendant, and we don't need even a complaint by the person whose rights have been violated. How satanically, sadistically, tyrannically evil is that? By the way, it's also unconstitutional. But who cares about trivialities like that, right? We don't even have this sucker approved by Congress, Senate. And the other improvements to the tyranny bill here include sentences of imprisonment as well as deterrent level monetary fines. In other words, for your use of that impression of the Wicked Witch, we'll find you, oh, I don't know, how does $100,000? Does that seem like it might deter you from ever speaking your mind freely again? Forfeiture and destruction of those items, materials, and implements. Forfeiture of any assets derived from the infringement. And the ability for the officials to take legal action against the alleged infringer on their own initiative without even requiring a complaint from the rights holder. This is called ex officio action. I think it would have been called ex officio when those folks outside Oregon, on the highway there, ex officio executed Lavoie Finicum. Might have been called ex officio when they took action against Antonin Scalia, too. All criminal procedures and penalties must be available, even if the infringement has absolutely no impact on the right holder's ability to exploit their work in the market. This allows state officials to, quote, take legal action into their own hands. Copyright players have now accomplished their long push for escalated criminal penalties. There was a line in here that I thought was kind of interesting. This was all done in secret. It was all done again, signed, supposedly, on February the 4th. And literally what it allows is an official to do what is right in their own eyes. Have we ever heard that term before? Send people to jail for an infringement that causes no harm to anybody. I guess you could say, if nothing else, well, this will do the one thing that it is clearly intended to do, and that is to put a chill on anybody who might want to report anything that might even remotely sometime in the future be called copyright infringement. Achtung, we have you now. And you will not be allowed to do this. Wow. Is the Torah written on our hearts? Is the Mishkan? Is it really a kind of a portable Mount Sinai? Is the Mishkan a place where the Creator can dwell within us? And I guess most importantly, do we understand what all of that means? Or have we been lied to the point where we completely missed everything that was once called law? Or miscalled law, because we don't understand what the words mean. Things have gotten really, really serious. Probably more serious than most of us would have believed, and we're there. So I'll conclude kind of the way I began. I would say time is up in so many respects. And I intended to speak today a little bit about some prophetic things. Don't think for one second that I'm suggesting that I believe that the second coming is real soon now. Or that Armageddon, the final battle, is coming. I tend to think that follows a long, long period of time, maybe 1,000 years after things that we'll see in the shorter term. Tribulation, so forth and so on. I tend to think the following. What we're going to see is a Fourth Reich and a meltdown of a lot of things economically. And probably World War III, but those things aren't the end of sorrows, that's the beginning of sorrows. And that then, if you go back and read Revelation and the book of Daniel and start putting the pieces together, what it looks like is, that is the excuse that is used to bring in something that is literally so nasty and evil, human heart is desperately wicked, that most of us still, even as cynical as we may be today, can't quite put our arms or our heads or our brains around it. So what I'm suggesting, in other words, is nasty times are here, and they're just beginning. And we're fixing to see the meltdown and the beginning of the end of the implementation of all of these things. And that what will come out of the things that we're seeing today, like the execution of all of those people that still believe in the God of the Bible and the rule of law and the Constitution, or anything that even remotely sounds like peons have rights, and that people like popes and presidents can't do anything they want with you, in spite of the fact that they're bald-faced, satanic, serving hypocrites. What follows, in other words, is where things really get ugly. And what we need to do is learn now to come out of her and to stand and to do the things that we can do. And I started to mention this last one. Pray and fast. Yeah, understand that we need to come out of a crooked economic system, monetary system, just-in-time system. If you're reliant on power grids, they probably will go away. If you're relying on ATMs or credit cards, they will almost certainly go away. If you put your faith in the almighty dollar, it won't last, but something will come and replace it that's going to be even worse, even more satanic, and even a bigger deception. And furthermore, if you are in a place where any semblance of the rule of law still exists, I guess I would encourage people who can to learn to carry now. Learn to exercise. If you don't exercise a right, you don't have it. As I sit here, folks, I have a 45 strapped to my waist. Oh, that's going to shock some folks. Because it's private property. And because what really amounts to law says shall not be infringed, but even in Colorado, where much of the law doesn't apply anymore, yeah, it's still okay. You can still open carry. And if you're in a state like that, you ought to do it. And you ought to do it anytime you can. so that people know and understand that there is what calls itself law that's not traditions of men, ordinances, statutes, things that are really done in violation of just about everything that once truly was law and what really is. And if we don't start exercising the little stuff that's, you know, still legal and certainly lawful, well, then how much more so when things really, truly get ugly? We've got neighbors. We've got so-called law enforcement and other people that need to be aware. I hope and pray that there's a lot of law enforcement that will listen to this and will ask themselves the question, who do I serve? Because I'll tell you what, if you put your hand on a Bible and think you're serving God and you've never read the thing that you took an oath to preserve and protect and defend, and furthermore, you don't even know the difference between nomos and law and his Torah, well, you got lots bigger problems. So may it be that all of these things will be something we can learn and walk in and teach. All right, this has been a long discussion today. I'll take one last peek, see if I see anything else. I know a lot of people have hung in there. So let us close in prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we thank you for your blessings, for your protection, for your provision. We thank you for your word. We thank you for your instruction, the whole of your word. We thank you that you came in the flesh and that you taught us in so many ways, and through the prophets as well, and through Moshe, and through our Yeshua. What is written, even if we've been told lies, even if we've inherited lies from our fathers, even if we got people who serve other gods and wear funny fish hats and tell us what you should have written if you were as smart as they are, we thank you that we can recognize that they are liars and the truth is not in them, and that what is true is your word. And we thank you that you have written it for us. We pray, Abba, that you would help us to have discernment, to rightly divide the word of truth, and to speak your truth boldly as we ought to, and to walk in it, and by our fruits to be known as those who serve you and you alone and seek your face. We pray, Father, for those who claim to be servants of yours and are not, that you would give them every opportunity to see and hear and to return, to make teshuvah to you. We pray for our loved ones, for our families, for wives, for other spouses, or for parents and children, siblings who may claim to know you but are walking in open rebellion, that you would chasten them. Give them every opportunity to see your truth. Open their eyes. Give them ears to hear. Give them witnesses. Let them hear the shofar, whatever it takes, Father. We love them. We know that it's not your will that any should perish. Bring them to you while there is time, because we know so clearly that time draws short. Father, further, we pray that you'd open our eyes, that we would be able to do in these times what it is that you would have us do. If that's to fast and pray, then let it be so. If it is to bear the arms that the law of the land says that we were able to do, whether it was a sword in the time of Kepha, or a firearm or other defensive weapon today, help us, Father, to do those things, but also to know that even though there is a time to take up arms, that you are our protector and our king and our defender and our redeemer and our salvation, and that our hope is in you. And as you defended David, who also took up arms and also wrote Psalms, we pray that you would protect and defend and guide us. Help us through these difficult times to be strong and of good courage. For you are Yahuwah Rapha. You are our banner, Yahuwah Nisi, Yahuwah Zevuot, Yahuwah Vitzivenu. You are the author and finisher of our faith, and we know that you are who you say you are. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad. All of this we ask in your name and by your authority and by the authority of your word. We thank you, we praise you. Hallelujah. Amen.